listening to The Core on the Envision Radio Network. Copyright 2014.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know.
Now.
This is Night Call, Detroit's longest running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the RIF at 4WRIF. That's 4974-3. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Why is it just hearing our names? It brings a smile to our face.
Because we're here again, Peter.
It's not just that we're these incredible egotists.
Speak
and
for yourself.
And narcissists.
No,
and all that. That's good. That's
no.
good. But we really
Maybe
do.
You a little.
Yeah, okay, that's true. But we'd like to hear from you at 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743. I'm just posting the guests on our Facebook page now. So if you, we'll be talking about it throughout the show. But I thought I posted it earlier, and you know, good old computers sometimes aren't so reliable.
You're going to try to... No, never mind.
I am going to... Yeah. No, I'm not going to try. I am going
okay.
to.
Okay. And that Facebook URL is facebook.com/nightcall. If you'd like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
So. And people probably wonder why calltalkyes. And that email originates from a syndicated
10 years
phone-in
ago.
Talk show that we did. And that was our number there, our phone number.
Sure.
So you turned it into our email, and that's why it's Call Talk Yes, because it's, a lot of times we're like, Call Talk No. But we do want to take your calls, and so much to talk about in the world.
Yeah, there's this ongoing thing. I don't think this is raising people's temperature too much, this whole thing with Russia and Putin and what have you.
Well, you know, it's just so off of the, no pun intended, the radar, so to speak. I mean, people are so caught up in pop culture. Hey, I'm guilty myself. I like myself some pop culture. You know, I like a little People magazine here and there. But it's just so disconnected from people's lives. And people also have extremely busy lives that they're like, oh, well, that's clear over there. That has nothing to do with me. Well, folks, it could have something to do with you. You never know.
Well, fortunately, although people have made these analogies with World War One, how this incident in Sarajevo in 1914 wound up with this huge World War One, and with
and who knows that, right?
Yeah, 20-30 million people getting killed and dying and what have you. But you know, it's interesting. Of course, everybody is understandably piling on Putin, this annexation of Crimea and all that.
Yeah,
but the Russians have some pretty legitimate grievances as well, to the point where I'd say what each side says about the other is equally true.
True.
Yeah.
My biggest issue with Putin is his stance on homosexuality. You know, he's a homophobe. He's a hater.
Yeah, and he's a very authoritarian government. On the other hand, the West is moving east, threatening Russia. Why in the world NATO countries should be recruited, or countries should be recruited to be in NATO, very close to Russia? Why there should be all these missile bases and all that are being put in ostensibly to protect Europe from Iran, which is nonsense. And Russia realizes that they, in fact, are aimed at Russia. The United States, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. I thought it was interesting, the New York Times article that you sent me, Peter, that military cuts render NATO less formidable as deterrent to Russia, that during the height of the Cold War, United States troops in Europe numbered around 400,000. Today, 400,000 troops in Europe. And today there's around 67,000 American troops in Europe, including 40,000 in Germany.
Yeah. There should be zero. There should be zero, though. In fact, I thought this was good. This probably wouldn't be easily understood. It says military cuts, you just read that, render NATO less formidable as deterrent to Russia. I'm thinking, good. Because, here, There's this all this nonsense about the Cold War, fiction, myths, actually, that
live on in people's minds today.
It says, in the past quarter century, the United States has divested itself of hundreds of bases, radios, and radar positions originally meant to protect Western Europe from the Soviet Union. The idea was the myth was that the Soviet Union was expansionist, that it had gobbled up Eastern Europe, and if it wasn't stopped by the West, it would gobble up Western Europe as well. That was like total nonsense. They knew, the policymakers knew at the time that the Soviet Union had no intentions to go West. Yet, the United States, particularly, had all sorts of plans to go east, to liberate, as they called it, essentially to bring those countries back into within the capitalist circle, not for freedom and democracy, but for markets.
I love the words they use. Freedom, liberation, you know, like we liberated the Iraqi people. Look what a mess it is over there right now.
Absolutely. And let's see, Pentagon officials will not make public precise details about the American arsenal of weapons and equipment in Europe for security reasons. Now, whose security is this? Does anybody really think that Russia, the Soviet Union, and they know all this now. All this stuff has been, all this policy and all these secret documents from the Soviet Union have all been released. And there was this absolute fear on the part of the Soviet Union that they were going to be attacked by the West. There was never a single plan ever devised by the Soviet Union to go any farther West than they already were. They wanted this buffer state. They wanted these allies. They wanted countries that would block Germany from attacking them for the second time in a century. It's not to make any brief with them or that they had the right to do it.
Look what they've done to, what Russia's done historically.
Yeah.
You know, you think about Afghanistan and on and on and on.
Yeah,
on.
Well, the point being is the Cold War was just based on an absolute fallacy and essentially was the myth was created in order to justify the military-industrial complex. To spend trillions of dollars on the preparation for a war against the Soviet Union never, ever intended.
The ongoing justification to this day, as a matter of fact, as the military-industrial complex is bigger than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a really interesting part of the article when it comes to Russia and NATO. Anthony Kordsman, a military analyst for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said, the limited ground forces in Europe are not designed to suddenly project power against Russia in a number of days. But basically, the most constructive thing you can do is not create such a challenge that Russia would feel compelled to respond.
Yeah.
In other words, don't stir up the hornet's nest.
And, truth be told, that's a good way to put it, but they're really not a hornet's nest. They're really in a defensive posture. Russia is. The whole Republican mantra is that that this all happened because Obama's weak. And John Stewart played, they being these righties, these Republicans, they get the talking points and they just hit them. So he, how he shows those sort of montages, like 8 or 9 Fox News commentators in a row saying, Obama's weak. Yeah, I did it out of weakness. Yeah, he's weak. And that was more weak policy. He's weak. He's weak.
Right.
I don't know what they thought would have been a strong response.
Or what would have been different under John McCain, because he would be doing the same damn diplomatic thing, right?
One would hope.
Don't you think?
I don't know. I hope so. I hope you would be right. But let's see. There was one other little factoid in here. Oh, yeah, that their American military presence in Europe is 85% smaller than it was in 1989. So what are the issues?
Just since then, wow.
Yeah, what are the issues between, for instance, the United States and Russia? Now, the United States is pretty far away from Russia and Ukraine.
Wait, not unless you're in Alaska.
Unless you're in Alaska, yeah, right.
Never going to let it go. You're right, I never am.
It's not a good situation when big countries do things that they can do just by a matter of their power. But on the other hand, it's not like they're occupying some country that doesn't want them there in the terms of Crimea. It was mostly Russians, and they overwhelmingly, I don't know if the election was held under the best conditions, but in other words, it's nothing that I think that really concerns the United States by itself or that we ought to be weak. they, the government, ought to be posturing about. And a lot of it is, this is so much about politics. In other words, Obama wants to look strong, and the Republicans want him to look weak. Why? Do they care about Crimea? Do they care about democratic or undemocratic processes? I doubt it. What they care about is the 2014 election.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as they say, whoever they are, it's all politics.
Right. And here, I don't know if I read this last week, but this with Russia, as with China, unnerved U.S. allies seek reassurances. So we're supposed to assure all these countries all around the world, nowhere near us. We're not assuring Mexico and Canada. We're assuring Japan and Taiwan and Poland and the Czech Republic. And it says, for President Obama, deciphering the motives, means, and next moves of these suspicious giants will require a mix of psychology and geopolitics. Criminology, this is Kremlinology, like for the Kremlin.
Right, not criminology.
Yeah, Kremlinology.
an odd twist.
And Sinology, you know, China, may end up as the major foreign policy preoccupations of the remainder of his presidency. I think I did read this. So these are presented as these strange ideologies that need this interpretation by a country that is not a suspicious giant. We're just in the world being, I don't know, the friend of everybody.
Yeah.
What a load of crap.
The fixer of everything.
Yeah.
You know, you...
Well,
you,
wait a minute. Or do you think so? Am I giving us short shrift? 248-544-WRIF.
On that note, you opened the show saying you don't think anyone's interested. Someone is actually on the phone wanting to talk about this very subject. I say we hit it while it's hot, Peter.
If I can only make this happen.
You can.
Okay. It's
John in Livonia. Don't say
John
it.
John from Anoville. John, hi. You're on the air.
Anoville, but Livonia's Livonia.
Thank you.
Oh, no, I was reading it backwards. Backwards, it's Anoville.
Okay, I never thought of it like that.
He's so childish.
Okay, I called about, we really should have sanctions against Russia. I mean, I hear that Liechtenstein has about $40 billion of Putin's money there, and if we freeze some of the assets and stuff like that and put the pressure on them, as opposed to having boots on the ground, the Russians might come to the peace table as opposed to... eat up the Ukraine.
Well, I don't think they have any intention to eat up Ukraine at all. And they understand that's probably a line that they can't cross. You know, there ought to be something like that happened in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Everybody thought, oh, I can't believe it. The Soviets are putting nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba. These shows what aggressive communist dominators of the world. Well, of course, the United States already had these nuclear-tipped missiles in Turkey. And what President Kennedy did was to make the secret deal with Nikita Khrushchev. You take these missiles out of Cuba, we'll take them out of Turkey. So what would be a good little... agreement here, forget about all these sanctions and all that, that's not going to get anybody anywhere, is to have the United States to agree to stop recruiting countries, as Reagan, by the way, promised Gorbachev, to stop recruiting countries in the East to be part of NATO, which essentially is an anti-Russian alliance. For what? For what reason? I don't know. We could do a lot by making moves that would create peace. We don't need to sanctions or anything.
You know, Kennedy, you think back to Kennedy and Reagan, they were strong presidents as far as the military, the industrial military complex is concerned. I mean, I was in the military during Reagan's administration, and we were proud. I served over in the Mediterranean, and as far as Diego Garcia, things like that, and we, you know, we carried the flag. But, you know, we got a weak president like, Obama here, you know, and he's grabbing at straws. You know, they say the Russians are playing chess and we're playing with marbles.
I think there's a difference between...
Hey, you're listening
between,
to right-wing radios.
Yeah.
I just heard that on a right-wing radio
there
show, my
go.
Friend.
Yeah, good job.
Well, there you go.
There's a difference from, I mean, being proud and it being necessary that we're there. There's a huge difference. I mean, yeah, so you're proud, you're there, you're doing what you signed up for, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so why would you go over there and not be proud?
Yeah, well, and remember, Reagan presided over the worst slaughter of American troops of in Beirut, and paid no political price for it whatsoever. I mean, weak? I don't even know what weak means when it. I mean, how is Obama weak?
He's downsizing the military. You know, we've lost a lot of stature overseas, stuff like that. I mean, Putin.
Well, wish he'd downsize
it
more.
Well, they are downsizing it because we don't need thousands of tanks. We don't need huge battleships anymore. That's not what war, if there's going to be a war. And why would we even be involved in the consideration of future wars? What is at issue with Russia, or what is at issue with China? Why is the United States even in the face of either of those countries, as opposed to saying, hey, why don't we sign a treaty that means we'll never go to war? Why doesn't the United States agree to a nuclear pact that would disarm both countries? Right now, the United States and Russia have 16,000 nuclear-tipped missiles. And the Russians have always been terrified that the United States was involved in planning for first strike against them by creating these missile shields, which the United States is doing again. The United States is way beyond its geography. Why is the United States in the Middle East? Why is the United States in Eastern Europe? Why does the United States have a Latin American command? Why does the United States have an Asian command? This is the prescription for war. We ought to just, hey, you know, what they used to call back in the 1930s, isolationism. That would be great. Russia doesn't want to take over the world for sure. It can't even deal with its own country. And China has no intention of taking over anything militarily.
Just economically? Just economically.
Yeah, economically, that's very possible. But there is all of these weapons, systems and troop concentrations and all that, that's something from the 20th century and ought to be dumped. All right, thank you, my friend. I got to go out to that city by the bay. It's David in San Francisco. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter, Julie.
Hi.
You know, I in listening to this discussion about the Ukraine, I've been studying this Saudi Prince Bandar, B-A-N-D-A-R,
yeah.
Ever since, if you remember back in the late summer last year, Syrian government was accused of gassing their own people, and
right.
We were just about to go to war in Syria, you know, toot sweet. And it turned out that Saudi Prince Bandar is basically the head of the Saudi Arabian CIA, he was the one that supplied the chemical gas to this little rebel group, and they didn't get trained, they didn't even know what they were shooting, and some of them blew up in their own little bunker and killed most of this little rebel group. And so they were really bugged. The couple of survivors told a reporter about it, and it led right to Bandar. And so Bandar was basically trying to trick America into going to war against Syria. And what wasn't known was that Syria had a secret alliance with Iran and a somewhat public alliance with Russia. And Bandar got busted with that, and he went on a crazy tear all last autumn, went on a bombing spree, basically did bombings in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Yemen, also up in Russia. You remember there was a bombing up in their transit center that...
You know, David, I mean, I think it's kind of attribute everything to Saudi Arabia. And for one thing, I mean, the idea that it was the rebel groups that did the gassing, I mean, I've heard that before. I think laying that at the feet of the Syrian government, I think, has just as much credibility and maybe more. And the fact that the Syrians agreed to get rid of their chemical weapons certainly turned out to be a good result of it. And the fact that the United States didn't do these military strikes on Syria. And and there's two people that Obama has to thank for that. One is Putin, who made the suggestion that they get rid of the chemical weapons and that would forestall any military strike. And then the Republicans. The Republicans started this whole big thing. You know, we're not getting involved over there. Of course, if there would have been, a President Romney or a President McCain, they would have been getting the 101st Airborne all ready for war. Fortunately, it didn't happen. All right, David, thank you very much. I appreciate your call.
I appreciate that David pays attention And, you know, like we, so many people don't even have any idea about anything he's talking about
sure.
because they're too busy worrying about the Kardashians.
Or just how to get some, what did Bush used to say, get some food on your family.
Oh, God.
Remember him? Remember George Bush?
I do not miss George
Bush. We had so much fun with him.
Hey, we sure did.
You know, I was watching NBC News tonight, and, of course, the bad news mostly come out of the television. Michigan and Michigan State, gone from the Elite Eight. Yeah, both got defeated. So it goes.
I was too busy preparing for the show.
There you go. Well, I had to watch it a little. But any event.
Well, that's a bummer.
Yeah. So I remember, you know, this. I would try to watch the network news because they're the most people watch those, and I think, well, that influences people and what they see is important. And I've stopped watching this ABC Diane Sawyer news because it is totally empty of real news, and it's always just.
Yeah, I never watch that. I don't watch CNN. I don't watch any of it.
So I started watching NBC, and it's the same thing. I mean, that's.
Of course it is.
They've changed.
They have?
Yeah. I mean, CBS, even though they're not great, still just all this kind of soft news. So they're this, you know, this endless story of.
I'm always amazed that you watch any of that.
Well, I do it. It's just sort of anthropology. I want to see what other people are watching.
I know, but you already know what's.
Well, I don't know what they're going to present.
Right. True.
I mean, I would look like we're talking about David from San Francisco. I'm looking at the same esoteric sites that he
right.
is. That's probably got a readership of 17 as opposed to 30 million, you know, or whatever
okay.
the hell they get.
So more what you want to know what's going on in the mainstream news.
Well, and how it's being presented.
Right.
Which means how they define or they can define what's power, the ability to define reality.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
No.
Ooh. Deep
okay.
man.
So the first thing, they've been leading all the time with Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which, I mean, incredible tragedy, but there's never anything new. I should have watched, I always record it, you know, so I can kind of blast through the ads and everything.
Yeah.
But they, so it went on and on, you know, they're flying planes, they had a reporter in one of the planes, and they spotted some debris, and then they, oh no, it was just a fishing net. And
it's so, like a soap opera,
yeah,
kind
it
of.
It was. But, well, I thought the best part of it, though, all, people are coming forth with lots of theories. Billy Graham's daughter.
Oh, this is a doozy.
Yeah. She sees the rapture in the Malaysian Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Billy Graham, this highly respected, never understood this, this highly respected Christian minister, who is really another one of these just far-right wing guys when you really get down, a pal of Nixon and all of that.
He's crazy, Peter.
Well, that's one way to put it. Here, if you've been waiting for someone to link the disappearance to Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 to the rapture, yeah, I was just waiting
mm-hmm.
for that. Thanks to the Reverend Billy Graham's daughter, your wait is over. According to Ann Graham Lotz, the disappearance of the Boeing 777 over the Indian Ocean could be a sign that the rapture might be right around the corner. Yeah. yeah, well, you know, most of these people I'd be glad to see go.
You know, if I were born into the Graham family, I would be the one person who would deviate from their so-called norm.
Now, the sister, Ann Graham, Graham Lotz.
The daughter,
yeah. Coupled with her brother Franklin's recent declaration of support for the way Russians, Vladimir Putin is dealing with gays in his country makes one think that March Madness extends far beyond the nation's premier basketball tournament.
Yes.
This is Bill Berkowitz at BuzzFlash.com. And this is what happened. Billy Graham's son supports Putin's anti-gay hysteria, according to Bill Berkowitz,
mm-hmm.
with a column vigorously supporting of Vladimir Putin's anti-gay crusade in Russia. Evangelist Franklin Graham finds himself edging closer to inheriting the mantle of Fred Phelps rather than that of his father.
Now let's
Billy
explain
Graham.
Who Fred Phelps is.
He's gone to. I mean, I'm sure he's not sitting at the feet of the Heavenly Father.
He's not. In the land of the living, let's put it that way. But he was head of that, what is the name of that church? I try to forget.
I can't remember.
Those crazies.
Yeah.
Have...
God hates soldiers. And
yeah,
God hates...
But they say the F word, and, you know, in terms of homosexuals. And would go to fallen soldiers' funerals and protest them.
And saying...
Because of the don't ask, don't tell stance by the United States military. I mean, how far-reaching is that?
Well, they sure got a lot of ink for being about 20 people.
Oh, yeah.
And
sure
FaceTime,
did.
Yeah. Billy, Franklin Graham, who now heads the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, which was started by his father, and the Samaritan's Purse, an international Christian relief organization, praises Putin in the March issue of the group's Decision magazine for signing a bill that imposes fines for adults who promote propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations to minors. The bill has unleashed numerous violent attacks on members of Russia's gay community. Now, old Billy himself was quite a guy. Reverend Billy Graham openly voiced the belief that Jews control the American media, calling it a stranglehold during a 1972 conversation with President Richard Nixon. This was from a tape that was done in the Oval Office, remember?
Yeah, and that's when Nixon said that the Jews controlled the media and went on and on and on and on.
Well, it was launched by Graham, though. He says the nation's best-known preacher, and this is, what, 50 years ago, 40 years, 46 years ago, this stranglehold has got to be broken or the country's going down the drain.
Oh,
this is Billy Graham talking to Nixon. Why, I mean, think about this. Nixon had all this stuff recorded, and he knew it was being recorded. I mean, what did he think? The people were going to say, oh, yeah, well, he's so cool.
Well, it's that typical position of power, where people think they're above everything and won't get caught.
Well, I know, but if you're setting your own trap.
It's so dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, to just bring it down to brass tacks.
So here's what Billy Graham said back in 72. This stranglehold has got to be broken or the country's going down the drain. And Nixon says, you believe that? Graham says, yes, sir. And Nixon says, oh, boy, so do I. I can't ever say that, but I believe it. And Graham says, no, but if you get elected a second time, then we might be able to do something.
And what would that something
be? I don't know. Graham later mentions that he has friends in the media who are Jewish, saying they swarm around me and are friendly to me.
God.
But he confides to Nixon, quote, they don't know how I really feel about what they're doing to this country. Why the Grahams have any respect whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
And on the ball, Jefferson, who's taking your calls at 248-544-WRIF, says it's the Westboro Baptist Church.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad I forget. If I need to remember again, I'll ask you, Jefferson. And I would like to state for the record that Jefferson works very hard for all three radio stations here in this cluster. He worked all day today. He is working now, mm-hmm. and he will be working all day today or tomorrow for Tigers opening day. So we appreciate your dedication to the program and the radio station.
Yeah. Yeah, have you ever been down to those opening day celebrations?
I have. I went to the last one that was at...
not Tiger Stadium.
Yes, the very last Tiger Stadium opening day.
That was 1938, I think.
No, it wasn't. It was a great time. I had so much fun.
Well, it was 1999. It was 15 years
ago. That's right.
Yeah.
It was a blast, and I'm glad that I actually made it, because I had just moved here.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad I actually made it to that old stadium so I could, you know, feel what everyone else feels about it.
I went to a lot of the last games at Tiger Stadium. WRIF had these seats right, and they called, what was it called? Right to the Tiger's Den? Was that it? Tiger's Mouth? I can't remember now. But it was right behind home plate. And you don't realize, and if you're used to being like a bleacher creature, being down there, and you can hear, you know, what they're saying to each other and all that.
See how fast that ball's going?
That ball is going fast. I was with somebody, and so a lot of these foul tips would come flying back, and there's a screen, right, to protect the patrons. But right to the right of it, there isn't. And every once in a while, the ball would come roaring back there. And so this friend of mine looking down, I'm saying, hey, keep alert. You know, this.
You didn't take your mitt?
I didn't take my mitt, no. Why don't we do this? I want to talk about smoking, both the legal and the illegal stuff, when we come back. In fact, I think we're going to come out of it with a song that's going to be talking about...
Well, do you just wait and see? How
All
about
right.
that?
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. the weekend. Brought to you by MetroPCS. Now with MetroPCS, the 29 for all sale. All 4G phones are just $29. No annual contract. The Rick.
Visualize with me. It's spring break. You're at the beach with the whole family. There's a light breeze. Oh, here comes your margarita. You're feeling warm and relaxed, wearing a long, flowing winter coat.
Yeah, that's not gonna work. Better head to Old Navy for some spring break steals. Pick up $5 tees and $10 swimwear for the family, plus $15 shorts for adults and more. Quick, that margarita's not gonna drink itself. Valid 317 to 401 on select styles.
And now, another great hit from Flo. Discounts from Progressive are good.
Why is a strike bad in baseball if it's good in bowling? And then someone told me about a basketball strike. That sounds bad, but I'm not quite sure. But I think we all can agree it's good to get discounts from Progressive.
Progressive offers lots of discounts to help you save.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states.
This is your Car Care Minute. Drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. Look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
When I grow up, I want to be a glass countertop in a new home.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's best birthday present.
When I grow up, I want to be a football stadium.
When I grow up, I want to be a warm place on a cold day.
When I grow up, I want to be a fancy backsplash.
I want to be a bike that races around the country.
When I grow up, I want to be a bench on a forest trail.
When I grow up, I want to be a rocking chair on
when
a sunny
I grow up,
porch.
I want to be a skyscraper.
I want to be.
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 When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. A public service advertisement brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hey, give us a call. Our number here, 248-544-WRIF.
All of my friends, we should be leaving town. And there really is better things to do than to be hanging around.
What's going to happen next weekend?
Peter, stop.
Michigan, and we're sending a protest wish again to all of those who still have ears. Let them hear.
What's it about?
Because we're going to the hash.
Are you a preacher?
Hash bash.
Hash bash. We're going to see some folks, and man, we'll have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. And we'll see you there. Don't be late.
That's next Saturday.
I ain't talking about crack.
And
it ain't about smack.
No way.
Hemp don't fit with dangerous stuff like that.
You make clothing out of it.
The soft drugs aren't the same, so let's call them by their name. We gotta make some changes, so let's start with hemp. Those are going to the hash. And over hash. And over hash bash. We gotta see some folks now, man, and have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. And I'll see you on the diag at U of M.
The old diag at the U of M. Yeah, that's going to be next Saturday at high noon. And I don't know, it used to be, I don't even know there is still a magazine called High Times. But
yes.
Is there? Well, they had, I remember the time that Drew and Mike, who was our morning show, and Trudy, who did the news, and me and a bunch of other people, we carried forth, broadcast live from the hash bag.
It cracks me up.
Yeah. Had T-shirts.
It seems like everything, have we gotten more prudish through the years?
I don't know, yeah.
As the laws have relaxed, we've gotten, not you and I, not prudes about it.
We had WRI with a big marijuana leaf and all that. John Sinclair was there. Chef Ra that used to teach how to cook.
He probably made
with the leaf.
Good stuff. And that's the edible trend is a big trend as the medical marijuana laws and Colorado and Washington, the state of Washington, have legalized marijuana. And there was a big, apparently, down at the Rooster Tail on Friday night, a big medical marijuana convention.
Right.
And a friend of mine went to that. I should have had her call in and give us a report tonight, but she's probably in bed by now. So
I actually have a medical marijuana convention, not convention. What would you call it? Where they all get together, kind of like a business thing. Maybe convention.
Convention.
I got one.
A what?
A T-shirt. Sorry.
Oh. I'm like, what?
Not a card. Not a card.
What?
But anyway, so the annual hash bash at the University of Michigan in this area of the campus called the DIAG is where they have every year this big rally. And there's been sometimes, I don't know, like 10,000 people. I think it may have been, I haven't been there in years and years, a lot smaller. But it's about demanding reform of the marijuana laws. But as we always say, be careful. It is if you get caught on the University of Michigan campus, you're breaking a state law, which is much more strict than the Ann Arbor laws. People think, oh, yeah, man, it's just a ticket if you get caught. And they have undercover agents. So
yeah, all over the place.
So that's,
and I just want to say, once you're in the system, you're in the system. Stay out of the system.
Yeah, okay. Actually, buddy, here. So that's the legal, illegal stuff. And of course,
there's some legal.
We know that, I guess increasingly,
you
depending on where you are, Washington State, Colorado, you get cards here. And, I got non-specific back pain, man. I need a medical marijuana card. But whatever, the times they are a-changing. As we know, there's multitude of harm that can come from marijuana. There's,
I'm like looking at you like, huh?
What's the harm?
Exactly.
You get high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know
what happens if you get high?
What?
You get high.
Right. That is a song right there.
Don't get behind the wheel, please. But how many people you think are smoked out behind the wheel as compared to how many people are drunk behind the wheel? On a Saturday night, this figure is so old, but they used to estimate that there were 25 million people every Saturday night behind the wheel that were over the limit.
Scary, and it increases as the night goes on.
Yeah,
later,
sure.
Those the more drunk drivers there are. I was actually in my car earlier tonight, and I saw the Detroit Bus Company. They have those. They bought a bunch of school buses, and they kind of, it's a little bit graffitied out, kind of cool looking. And it was about half full of people cruising around on the bus. And I think that's great. It's a great trend.
Sure.
The only thing about the bus thing is people think, oh, well, we'll just get hammered and ride around in the bus. Well, then when they get back to their car, they got to figure that out. So,
Have you heard those ads? They say they have a guy saying, oh, when I'm hammered, I just take the side streets home. And then they have a guy saying, I'm a police officer and I'll get you.
Yeah, the side streets don't matter anymore.
And it was, what is this thing about wearing a hat? A guy says, I'll wear a hat. And he says,
oh, I've heard that commercial,
What does that mean? What does wearing a hat mean?
Somehow it's a disguise?
I don't know.
I mean, weaving, it doesn't matter whether you're wearing a hat or not.
I got an anti-weave device on my car.
Really?
Yeah, it reads, these cameras read the dotted line.
So they're making it easy to drink and drive?
Well, no, if you start to go over it.
Something like that.
If you just go over a little bit, it jiggles the wheel.
That's weird.
And every once in a while, it says, driver alert, you should pull over and rest for 5 minutes. And I keep saying, I say, what did I do?
You know? See, I don't want a car telling me what to do like that. Yeah. I'm going to keep it simple.
All right, here we got somebody else from Analville. It's Mike.
Well,
Mike,
how
you doing?
How are you going on with this?
Forever. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going tonight?
Going good. What's up with Hash Bash?
Well, you know what? I've been to Hash Bash a couple times, and... You know, there's no harm, no foul there. You know, you do what you got to do. Some people enjoy it for multiple different reasons, you know, an escape or just a way of opening their minds. And if there's something wrong with that, you know, it's at the point where it's getting prescribed to people in different states. Look at Colorado.
Sure.
It changed their whole state.
Yeah, they're making a lot of money.
You know, Mike, I was just reading about a guy who was driving in Montana and got pulled over because he had Colorado plates.
Okay, so you get a reputation, of course. Why wouldn't they? They have to make an example out of somebody, right?
Well,
the feds are against it. That's a big problem. If you don't get Washington involved, it's going to be a battle between state and government, you know, at a national basis, and that's not good.
Let me ask you a question. When's the last Hash Bash you were at? What year, do you remember?
Man, it was probably around like 2002, 2003.
Oh, it was a long time. It was probably about when I was there as well. I'm wondering whether there's still big crowds. And because when I was there, it was an enormous crowd. It was maybe like 10,000 people, maybe more. I don't know.
It was out of control, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, it wasn't out of control.
In a good way, right?
In a good way. It was off the hook.
I'm not saying it was a horrible situation for anything down there. Yeah. If anything, the whole city benefited from the event.
Yeah, it's big, you know, everybody had to eat, everybody had to get gasoline, all those things work. Yeah, that's for sure.
Well, that's all part of it, you know. So Detroit's looking for something to get it back on the map, something to get the county that going, something to make some money, generate some income. Is marijuana the next step for Detroit? Because if that's on the forefront of medical uses and, you know, and if it is being abused a little bit, what medical prescription drugs aren't being abused on some level? Is that something that Detroit should look forward to and embrace and be part of?
I thought there was some ordinance that was passed.
Yeah, there was, but someone needs to clarify that.
Because we don't know. How many people do you think are harmed by, as you said, very, very appropriately, by prescription drugs as opposed to marijuana?
Or in Detroit, would you rather have heroin and coke or weed?
Or anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we'll let that out to people. Mike, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. Phone number is 248-544-WRIF. So,
yeah, and, I was going to read an email.
Go ahead.
If you don't mind. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We were talking a lot about the situation in Russia, Ukraine, and
the military.
And the military in general. George from Taylor writes, as of March this year, contractors made up 57% of the Pentagon's force in Afghanistan. And if the figure is averaged over the past 2 years, it is 65%, according to the report by the Congressional Research Service. So the argument of downsizing the army is a canard by the Republicans. I thought that was great.
Thanks, trick, George. A joke, yeah. Right. Okay, so we dealt with the illegal smoke, the marijuana, or illegal. It looks like it's going, you know, out of here. But here, this was pretty interesting. When smoking first swept the United States in the early decades of the 20th century, that's interesting, too, that it because they were mass-produced for the first time. They had the machines that could do it. It took hold among the well-to-do, the wealthy. Cigarettes were high society symbols of elegance and class. And then, of course, into the 40s and 50s, many of us have seen, they would have ads in those magazines like Collier's and Look Magazine and Life Magazine. And they'd have doctors smoking cigarettes and singers saying, these cool my throat, you know, or what have you. By the 1960s, however, smoking had exploded, more imploded, I would say. Had exploded. That's right. Helped by the distribution of cigarettes to soldiers in World War II. Half of all men and a third of women smoked.
My gosh.
Yeah. You know, they used to, the real, before filters came in, that was kind of a way they figured, okay, we're going to protect smokers from what people began to realize
by
was
using
a problem.
Filters?
By using filters. But cigarettes used to be unfiltered. And you... Lucky Strike, yeah. Lucky Strike. What was it? LSMFT. What does that mean? Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
Oh,
God. How do I remember this?
Because now MF is something, a whole other thing.
Yeah, right, right. But as evidence of smoking's deadly consequences has accumulated, the broad patterns of use by class have shifted. Smoking, the leading cause of preventable death in the country, is now increasingly a habit of the poor and the working class, which is pretty interesting given that it is so expensive. I have no idea how much cigarettes cost. They may cost
You've always said this, though. I mean,
$7. I think they're $7 a pack.
Yeah.
People buy Lucy's, though.
But
singles, you know. You just,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, certain places.
Get those. Or they have just the generic, they have generic ciggies, too, that are cheaper. And another trend that a lot of people are doing is buying loose tobacco and rolling their own cigarettes because it is way less expensive.
Way cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some people think it doesn't have all those additives. Some of it doesn't. What is it? Indian something? I don't know.
Well, American Spirit.
Oh, American Spirit.
But those are the most expensive ones.
Oh, are they?
Just as, like, it's like buying organic food. It's more expensive than regular food.
Well, while previous data established that pattern, that it was a habit of the poor and the working class, a new analysis of federal smoking data released on Monday shows that the disparity is increasing. The national smoking rate has declined steadily, but there's this deep geographic divide as well as class divide. In the affluent suburbs of Washington, about 10% of the people smoke, but in impoverished places like Clay County in eastern Kentucky, nearly 4 in 10 people do, 40%. Ed Smith, 51, holding up his cigarette in a hand, callous from his job clearing trees from power lines, said, "It's just what we do here." That's sad, too.
I'll tell you what. You go over to Europe, go to Paris. I was in Paris. Everybody smokes over there.
How long ago?
I was there 10 years ago.
Still,
and it's
still
the same way. Yeah. I have my friends who live in Spain. I have friends who live in Paris. I have friends who live in Denmark. Everybody smokes over there. They don't get all uptight about it as we do here in the United States.
I wonder if they still do. Anybody been in Europe lately?
Yeah. My friend lives there now, and she told me. She goes, "Julian, I don't know why everyone's so uptight over there in America."
This is called, Julian, a call grabber. I'm trying to get...
Whatever. Go ahead.
But, yeah, I remember when a friend of mine and I were bicycling over there, and these French friends of ours thought we were weird because we didn't smoke at dinner, during dinner, these Gauloises, these very strong cigarettes, and we didn't think white bread was good for you.
Right. Everything in moderation.
Yeah. 248-544-WRIF.
That's 248-544-9743. Anything that we've talked about, or if you have any particular topics of interest that you would like to bring up, hey, bring it on.
You know, I just committed a real class snobbery, and I want to clean it up. And I tried a little, but I ought to do it a little more. When I quoted this Ed Smith, I went into the accents, just what we do here, you know, and Clay County in eastern Kentucky. He's a poor man. He sounds like he's a hard worker clearing trees from power lines. He says several of his friends have died of lung cancer. He has, and here's the important part, he has tried to quit, but so far has not succeeded. And here's the really sad quote. "I want to see my grandson grow up." Here is this death-dealing substance that is this major source of revenue for states. And is there federal tax in? I'm not even sure. 400,000 people die a year from smoking-related causes. A lot of what we wind up paying, taxpayers, and that's, you know, that's, what is it, amortized? Is that what you, but I mean, it's spread out among all of us, right? In fact, we ought to talk about Obamacare a little while as well. The growing gap in smoking rates between rich and poor is helping drive inequality in health outcomes as well. White women on the lowest rungs of the economic ladder now living shorter lives. For instance, smoking is leaving fancy places, these big urban areas, but it has remained in the poor and rural areas. Americans with a high school education or less make up 40% of the population, but account for 55% percent of the nation's 42 million smokers. 42 million people smoking. Well, maybe the fact that only 400,000 die is...
Yeah.
Try to do the math. I can't.
Don't
it's like
one
math. Tenth of 1% or
well,
something like
that. It's extremely difficult to quit, and sometimes that is it's a crutch that makes people. I mean, it gives you a certain sense of relaxation.
I'm not
going to say I don't have a cigarette once in a while. You know that, Peter.
The nicotine does that.
And these are stressed out people, and this de-stresses them.
Yeah, and
so
you know,
I'm just going to show, you're such a hater on smoking, and I'm not. But.
Well, it is so bad for people, and it chains people, and these corporations are so horrible. These tobacco companies make corporate contributions to local causes. You go, so they think, oh, they're good people, and they aim advertising campaigns at low-income areas and even sell cigarettes more cheaply in those areas. These are horrible son of a bitch.
That's
all I can say.
It is what it is, and I don't care what those corporations do. I'll go after a corporation right now, almost any of them, and you know that. But if the people are going to smoke, no matter what.
Well, think about this, though. I don't know what we're going to say. Maybe that they shouldn't make sure there's no crop subsidies for tobacco growers, which I'm
sure
there are.
Or maybe clean up the crops and not put so much crap in it.
In the tobacco itself. Yeah. But, I mean, think about, that old classic rock song, Goddamn the Pusher Man by Steppenwolf?
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, but here, I mean, how many people are addicted to heroin or crack? I mean, it could be in the hundreds of thousands.
Well, heroin's on the rise.
Yeah, it is. But compared to smoking, 42 million? There's nothing like that. And why doesn't anybody say...
Well, you can just go to the store and boom, there you go.
Yeah.
It's easier to get.
With the national smoking rate stabilizing in more recent years, experts say that reaching poor and working class smokers, whose problems often include alcohol and drug abuse and mental illness, is crucial to achieving further declines and reducing the heavy financial burden that smoking puts on the healthcare system. Well, we go back to Ed Smith, who says that he's tried to quit because it is the most addictive substance of any of the drugs.
Yep.
More so, you can't even get addicted to marijuana. You get habituated. It becomes an important part of your life. I've known people like that. But we ought to be aiming our real, our real vitriol. God damn
the pushman.
The tobacco man.
Okay.
The tobacco man.
All right.
Let's go to Nate. Nate's in Waterford. Nate, hi. You're on the air. Welcome to the broadcast.
Not too bad. How are you doing?
Good.
Nice to talk to you. Go ahead.
Well, we were talking about this weed situation here. Now, the one thing I want to say is, let me give you a few 8, 10 years, 15 years back. When I was a kid, we were smoking weed in the closet, so to speak, before it was all legal. And It was no big deal. We went to work. We got off work. We smoked a little bit of smoke and everything. And nowadays, it's a different story. Now they got these growers to where this weed is way stronger than we ever had before.
Yeah, you're right. But, I mean...
You know, it's like...
And the problem is...
But people want that.
Well, that's true. Don't get me wrong. But what... The one thing I got to say is the kids can get into that just as easy.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what do you mean by kids?
I have no... Well, here's the thing. When we had our growery back in Pontiac back in 1992, I lived in Pontiac off of... I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, you should. Sure.
But we had, 300 and some plants back before it was cool to grow it. Back then, we was growing it illegally.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Well,
but
still 300 plants is still illegal. Yeah. I mean, I knew this guy who got busted, had a grow house with 400 plants.
That's a lot.
And he said, "Hey, I've got a license to grow." And they said, "The limit is 12." He said, "Oh, I misunderstood.
I thought it was 1,200."
Well, back then we didn't even have the license to go.
Right.
But we kept it. Nobody even knew it was in their basement.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So even when the kids came over to hang out in the yard and stuff like that, nobody knew it was down there. We kept it away from them. 100%. That's the problem I have with it today. It's like, okay, you can smoke your weed. I have no problem with that. But you got to keep it away from the kids.
Just like your guns, just like everything
else.
Yeah,
I mean, there are certain things that adults should use. I mean, I don't know when you, when the age of consent or whatever you would call it would be, or when it's advisable. I guess you don't want, even though there are a number of young people, say kids 13, 14, 15, 16, that are just stoners.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, that it probably isn't good for emotional growth or intellectual growth. And there's certain things like, you know, we don't want kids smoking.
I'm not sure I even buy that.
I don't know.
I really don't.
Well, you know, it's hard.
11
to...
maybe, but when you're.
Well,
older,
yeah, when,
teen...
when is the cutoff date? I mean, when all those
and
things.
And who decides that?
Yeah, when, like, for instance, well, it used to be very structured within all cultures when things would occur. Like, for instance, when is appropriate for young people to have sex?
But you. Do not like that type of structure.
No, well,
you don't want that. You strived your whole life for that.
But
that lack
I'm not advocating it.
Right?
But I'm saying, you know, when should a young man or young woman in this society have sexual relations?
When they want to, and
when they're 13,
informed.
Well,
I don't
maybe
know,
they're not 13 informed.
13-year-olds are doing it.
They are
all the time.
Yeah, but people, you know, there's a. Well, they just did this.
I mean, if I had children, I probably wouldn't want them doing that. But
right.
That's just because of the way I was raised.
Yeah. There was an article today in the New York Times about the effect of pornography on kids. And you know what they all decided? They don't know what the effect is, whether it's good, bad, indifferent.
Well, it depends on the content of the porn.
Well, they were saying, yeah.
There's some pretty nasty stuff out there.
Well, the point being is that this is all kind of up for grabs. When should people drink booze? Well, wasn't it 21? It's 21,
yeah.
Right? Well, why can't you drink it when you're 20 and 6 months? What's the difference,
yeah.
Right? Or it used to be 18. And
oh, they're going to do it anyway.
You know, when I was drinking when I was 16. And
yeah, it was
I made it.
It was 19 when back then. But I was in the bars with braces and pigtails at 16.
Fake ID.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. All right, Nate, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I got some more calls. We're going to get those in just a little bit. We're going to take a break and
hang on the line. We'll
right.
be with you.
248-544-WRIF. When I don't give the number, neither
sometimes
does Mr. Announcer.
Does.
Let's see if he does.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Hi, I'm Joe Theismann. No matter what stadium I broadcast from, I'd always have to find the closest bathroom, just in case I had that sudden urge to go. My prostate was giving me fits, but then I heard about Super Beta Prostate's nationwide million-bottle giveaway, and I got a free bottle. What a difference it made. I don't have to go as often, and I don't have to get up at night as much. Now I wake up refreshed and ready to tackle anything. What's so special about Super Beta Prostate is that it's the most widely used supplement supporting a healthy prostate. Super Beta Prostate has sold over 5 million bottles, and it also has a trusted 10-year history, and it's all natural. There's no reason to accept the issues that come with an aging prostate. So get Super Beta Prostate today.
Call right now when you learn how to get a free bottle of Super Beta Prostate. Pay only shipping and handling. Call 1-800-459-7640. That's 1-800-459-7640. Hurry, supplies are limited. Call 1-800-459-7640. That's 1-800-459-7640.
During these tough economic times when many families are living paycheck to paycheck, it can be easy to lose sight of the importance of saving for the future. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants you to know there are some simple steps you can take to set aside dollars each month for retirement, college tuition, or unexpected expenses that could come your way. Most important is to review all your expenses and establish a monthly budget. Then examine every spending category and cut 10% from each. You can't reduce fixed expenses like rent or mortgage or a car payment, but you can easily cut back in many other areas like entertainment or using mass transit when possible instead of driving. And take a look at trying to bundle services such as your cell phone, land phone, cable TV, and internet service. For more tips and to speak with a certified credit counselor who can start you on the right track, call the NFCC at 800-388-2227 or visit debtadvice.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
This is your Car Care Minute. Drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. Look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Mind Flowers in action. The Riff.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Alice Slater. She's from a group called Abolition 2000, and talking about the threat, I mentioned this earlier, of the 17,000 nuclear weapons that are still possessed by the United States, Russia, and a bunch of other countries. The Russia and the United States have 16,000 of them. The other six, seven countries have 1,000. Also, Marion Nessel, author of Eat, Drink, Vote, talks about how food politics determines what we eat and ultimately our health as well. Now, there was something else in all of this that I've got to tell you. Oh, yeah. And I want to, by the way, if you're on hold at 248-544-WRIF, just stay there a second. We'll get you in a second. March 31st, ooh, we're there.
Yes.
This is it. Last day to register for Obamacare, this article.
For the year.
For the year, yeah. And the last day is today, Monday. And last-minute applicants for health insurance strained enrollment offices over the weekend, triggering long lines, extra security, and hours of waiting across the country ahead of Monday's federal deadline. Healthcare.gov, the federal website, blocked some applicants late Friday but didn't show major technological problems.
So, now, they were hoping to get 6 million people signed up.
I think they got that.
And it's over that number. They've reached their goal. You know who I learned that from? The Reverend Al Sharpton. I listened to his show on the way in on Sundays.
He's on the air?
Yeah. We can't talk about it.
Wow. Though. Okay. Yeah.
He's on FM radio, believe it or not.
Wow. Well, here, healthcare is here. Government healthcare is here. Government subsidized healthcare is here. If any of you have experiences with it, I'd like to hear about it because this is odd. We've been talking about this ever since this was passed and asking you, have any of you signed up? I actually have spoken to a couple people who have, and most of them are pretty happy with
it.
But, you know, I heard on the way in here, and I just think it was on a regular news show, and I understood what was going on. And some young person, sounded like from his voice, said, I'm making $7.25 an hour, and even with subsidized payments, this is still a hit for me. Plus, if you've got the bronze plan, the lowest plan, it's like a $2,600 deductible.
Yeah. I have a bronze plan. It's $5,000 deductible, but I'm just happy to have any health insurance at all.
Yeah, so
I didn't do mine through Obamacare.
So a lot of people are what they're doing. They say it's cheaper for me to pay the penalty, the tax penalty.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, lots.
And so the system.
Think of the numbers: 42 million.
Yeah.
Uninsured people, 6 million signed up. Look at all the people. Right. You know.
So
you can do that math.
And this has been because the Republicans blocking all of this, including the price of things, because had they agreed to having a public option that would have competed with these private insurers, the costs would have been a lot lower. So it's the Republicans are committed to two things. They're not committed to repealing Obamacare because once it's here, it's here. They're not. If they won big in, say, 2016 and got both houses of Congress and elected a president, and they would say, okay, by then, say there's 8 or 10 million people. Okay, sorry, none of you have health care anymore. Yeah, there'd be riots probably. But what they want to do, they want to make this perform as badly as possible, just like they want the economy to perform as badly as possible. So this will allow them to get the reins of power, because ultimately they don't care about any of this. What they care about is being able to get more money for more corporations. That's it. That's the long and the short of it. That's why they're trying to make it harder and harder for potential Democratic voters to vote, all of that. We can talk about that a little longer. So, what Obamacare shows to me is that there's even a greater need for more government involvement in health plans like every other country has. There should be a single payer government health plan just that works very, very well every other country.
Feel like a broken record.
Feel like a broken record. Yeah. That's the message here. All right. Let's go back to, your calls. Here is Yaya is calling from Dearborn Heights. Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys today?
We're good.
Hey, Yaya.
Hey, Jolene. Hey, Venezuela situation, it's not good. Everything went up, believe it or not, 300%. So whatever people couldn't afford, they can't afford anything right now.
And we're talking about Venezuela. I don't think that was real clear. Go ahead.
Yes, Venezuela. Gas price is about to go up tomorrow. That's going to bring more chaos to the cities that everything, obviously.
Well, let me tell you this. Having been in Venezuela, I know that any time that any president going way back tried to raise the price of gasoline. But gasoline, what? When I was there, it was 14 cents a gallon. It was cheaper than water.
Yeah, well, now it's going to be going up more than 14 cents. Right now, people are waiting in the supermarket since 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're only allowed to buy one item per person. For example, one piece of meat, one piece of chicken, one...
Well, let me ask you this. What's the message here? It seems that Venezuela is really a mess. There's a democratically elected government. These middle-class and upper-class people particularly don't like what's going on, so they start erecting barricades in the street. This engenders blowback. Government supporters, I just read, these government supporters just shot into this crowd, killed two protesters. But, you know, there's elections there, and they were pretty close last time, so the appropriate manner wouldn't be what they're doing. I mean, they should have nonviolent demonstrations and what have you, but they think they're in Ukraine, and they've initiated violence, and it's coming back at them.
It's more than two people that have been getting killed.
Oh, no,
for example, it's been getting more people. For example, one of the guys that we grew up with, he just got shot a couple of days ago in front of his kids. You know, it's very sad. You know, people with tear gas. My best friend's son, he's been affected. Healthy boy, now he has asthma because of the tear gas that in Cuban, and please let me explain this to you, it's the Cuban National Guard that is attacking the people. It's not the Venezuelan.
You know what? You said that before. I don't buy that for a second. The Venezuelan military is certainly, and the police forces are certainly strong enough to take care of themselves. The only thing I'm saying is that the Venezuelan middle class and the upper class that have always resented the fact, they never complained about when there was other dictators and what have you. They were fine with that. But when you get a rather authoritarian government like the Chavez and Maduro government, all of a sudden they want to start erecting barricades. And what they have initiated is class warfare. And what's coming back at them are these working class people that have benefited from the socialism, from the co-ops and the Cuban doctors and all of that. And they're saying, hey, we're not going back to the old way that it was. I have no support for the Maduro government. I may have told you when I was in Caracas, I took part in a demonstration administration against Chavez, so I don't have any brief for him either. But they're going about it the absolutely wrong way. There's elections, and even with the authoritarian control of a lot of the state mechanism, the electoral process, and the television and all that, they almost defeated Maduro.
But some points in time, you have been supportive of Chavez.
Well, I'm supportive of the fact that he opened up the country to not just the middle class people, but that created all these reforms that reduced poverty. I mean, the economy seems screwed up, but the poverty has been reduced substantially in Venezuela.
No, but see, it's not, okay. It's a Cuban proof. There is a fact, and as soon as I get the fact, Peter, I will send it to you. The Cuban National Guard right now, it's attacking. There's martial law in one of the states in Venezuela. Nobody's allowed to go out. After 6 o'clock today, there was nobody allowed to go out. If you went out, guess what? You will get shot. They will kill you. They will kill you right there on the spot.
I'm sure.
There's friends of ours. There's friends of ours that they got killed and shot. There's people that we know that we don't know where they are right now because the National Guard, they took them, and we don't know their whereabouts.
Well, you know, that's terrible. But you know what? That happens in the United States. Well, look what happened to Occupy in Oakland or in New York or places like that. Well, there was, you know, it's not to that extent. It was in the 1960s. Governments don't react well when they're assaulted. And generally, the smart way to go about it was through the electoral process. There, you can have demonstrations, you know, like I say, I was in this demonstration in Caracas against Chavez's policies. What was initiated, you know, they saw, oh, look what happened in Ukraine. Let's do the same thing here. Well, they're going to wind up creating in Venezuela. And I'm not, you know, I'm against any violence whatsoever. So the fact that the government employs repressive sources, whether it's domestic or foreign or whatever, I completely oppose it. But I just don't want to make it sound like, you know, the people that have been protesting are completely innocent, haven't been doing anything, and just this terrible, awful government has been attacking them. I don't think that's what's going on.
It is so many things that I need, you know, to explain to you guys. And I know that, you know, we'll take the whole show. And obviously, I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to be fair. There's things that's happening in the country. Yes, you're right. They might be manifesting, but they're protesting because when they went to protest the first time on the 12th of February, Maduro gave the right away. I don't want nobody to manifest. I want whoever is going to be in the street protesting, I want them shot. I want them killed. Chavez did not do that. Chavez said, if you're going to protest in peace, that's fine. I will give you the freedom of doing that. So when Maduro did, he went the opposite way, and then he started shooting people. The first guy that got killed was 2 blocks away from my house, is still in Venezuela. Okay, that's why everybody is racing in the street. That is why everybody is doing whatever they're doing. Now they're talking that might be a coup, a military coup, because of the way that the Venezuelan people is acting out. Now, it's just a mess.
Well, it is a mess. And, I mean, you got to remember, you know, the right wing pulled off a coup against Chavez, who was a democratically elected president. What was it, 19 or 2002 or something like that? And I know there has been, I don't know, 70 or 80 people killed and some on both sides. And the two people that I mentioned today, when these masked, they think they're probably, either police or National Guard, when they went to break up these barricades, and these two people that were killed today weren't anywhere near the barricade. So there's obviously official abuse, I mean, without a doubt. Listen, do this for me, Yaya. Send me stuff. I mean, I'm always into it, and I don't like governments, and governments are almost always repressive. But a lot of these people, they just want to go back to the old days. They don't want any of these. What do they call them? They call the people that are supporting the government the colectivos, because they were able to put in these collectives that brought people food, brought people medical care, brought people some hope that was never there under these before Chavez. To the when governments are attacked, they get desperate. They'll do anything. You're right. They'll shoot people down in the street, and they're doing it now. I agree with you. All right, send me stuff.
The only thing that I would argue with you with about Peter, which is so rare, people are like, oh, my gosh, is any comparison of Venezuela in the United States.
All right, well, okay. All right, thank you very much. Well, I don't know. I was just watching, you know, in Arizona, in Tucson, there was, you know, it's not killing people, but there, I don't know if you saw these films after this, you know, Arizona won, you know, one of the games in the March Madness. And there's this huge guy taunting the police. He's just standing in the middle of the road. He's got like shorts and a suit jacket on, and he's got his hands up in the air, and he's yelling and yelling and yelling. All of a sudden, about eight cops just jump him and smack him in the face and knock him down.
And that's one guy.
Yeah, well, listen, you know.
I mean, there's no excuse for that.
Yeah.
I'm not excusing them by any means.
Well, no, I'm not trying to, you know, where you got to go back? You got to go, you know, depends on what the threat is. During the 1960s, police killed a lot of people. During the 1930s, to try to stop unionization, they killed hundreds of people.
Right.
Literally hundreds of people.
But how many are dying in Venezuela?
Well, I don't know. I thought the figure I saw was 70 or 80. But there's also been people killed by these right-wingers. When I was in Caracas, we had to be there. What would happen? These right-wingers would get up on these buildings and shoot into the crowd.
Right.
The only way we could march successfully would be to be protected by these full battle-ready. When I was in this World Social Forum march, they had to have battle-ready combat troops protecting us. So, on one hand, I don't have any brief for the Maduro government, and I don't know why they can't get stuff together, you know, given that they have this oil wealth.
Clearly, oil doesn't mean peace.
And,
it means the opposite.
And one of the things is that the middle class that always benefited before this socialism came in, they despised Chavez right from the beginning, that he was beginning to erode their privilege, to end poverty, to you know, destroy their little golf courses and put up housing for the poor in the middle of Caracas and all that. So, I don't know.
But important we talk about it.
Yeah. All right. Here's Tim. Tim's in Lincoln Park. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. I called up initially to talk about drugs, but I kind of want to weigh in on Venezuela real quick.
Sure.
Okay. You know, I mean, any government, I guess, whatever its ideology, left or right, I'm sure it can be seen as abusive on some level. But we have to understand, and I've sort of been following this for the last few months, the principal instigators of this protest are really right-wing. I mean, they're even far righter than the Tea Party here. These guys are entrenched middle-class and upper-class, basically super-capitalists. They want to destroy any kind of advance that the Chavez and Maduro governments have made in the lives of the people. I mean, the lives of the people have been improved. Literacy rates have gone up. A lot of people's housing has been improved. And as for the oil wealth that hasn't gone to the people, you have to understand a lot of these wells are controlled by these same capitalists who want Maduro and previously Chavez overthrown. So these guys in the streets are largely useful idiots to these guys, okay? They're not kind of like you and Jolene who go out there protesting on behalf of the people, man. These guys are rich. So Yaya is just, I just kind of question her whole like sourcing for her whole comments. You know, I mean, most of these people who have been killed by the right wingers. I mean, I think the government has killed, which I'm not happy about at all, people themselves. But the majority of the people killed were by these right wing protesters and paramilitary. So we have to kind of put that in perspective. That if you see protesters on the street, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily on the side of the people. They might be on the side of, let's say, you know, forces that were there before.
Well, you know, in fairness, though, both Chavez and Maduro have made the government much more authoritarian. You know, it's still to the point.
Can I kind of respond to that a little bit?
Okay,
it's sort of like with the whole media clampdown thing. On the one hand, you know, the right to free speech in any society is sort of seen as a fundamental right. But the thing is, a lot of the media, before it was clamped down in Venezuela, it was kind of like if every media outlet here was Fox News. And so
controlled by the government.
You know, it's kind of like, but I mean, this is all private, though, right? So it's kind of like, let's say, like, if you turned on your TV, we had Fox News all the time. So the government said, hey, you're not getting any kind of real info out here. It's all Fox News. Well, what is society to do? Just allow private enterprise to just run roughshod over even media in the name of free speech? So it's sort of a conundrum. because, you know, we sit around and go, well, free speech, that's the answer for everything. But if free speech descends into pure propaganda, is there any kind of responsibility for the political state to step in? Now,
well, I'll tell you, when I was there, I have never seen a more vitriolic opposition press in my entire life.
And
I
mean, that was under a different...
Well, that was under Chavez, yeah.
Yeah, how long ago was that?
But about 2006, that's 8 years ago now. According to some of this, I'm just looking this up, there are Cuban advisors in Venezuela's army. Well, if that's some horrible state of affairs, I don't know what that says about what the United States does, sending so-called advisors all over the world, including sending tens of millions of dollars to disrupt the Venezuelan government. That's where part of our tax dollars go.
I remember Bush, he tried to overthrow Chavez back in 2002, and I don't know if Maduro is telling the truth, but he claims a lot of the protesters now are getting financed by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the CIA front in the United States.
That's what I mean. They are. They are indeed.
And those guys were, you know, you heard that call by Newland, right? She was talking to one of her kind of flackies. She was saying she wanted to replace Yanukovych with the present guy. And she even told the EU to go to hell. I mean, so they sort of had it lined up in Ukraine to kind of overthrow the Yanukovych, and he got tossed. Of course, the Russians, being authoritarian, kind of responded in kind. So a lot of these governments, they're not, you know, even though categories of left and right sometimes break down with these governments and societies, because unfortunately, power often tends to adhere to power. And,
sure,
and the
idea, yeah,
the ideal aspirations of people, let's say on the left, often get crunched. You know, you go back to the Soviet Revolution, right? That was supposed to be about peace, land, and bread and all that crap, right? Well, you get Lenin, you get the Red Terror, then you get Trotsky, who was killed by the Stalinists. And I've talked to the Trotskyist about this. I said, well, even if your boy Trotsky won, he would have been just as bad as Stalin anyway.
He was. It was the battle of the bureaucrats and Trotsky. But, hey, give me just like the headlines with the thing you wanted to talk about, drugs, because I should move on.
Okay. When I was a kid, look, everything was wrong. You couldn't masturbate. You couldn't smoke weed. You couldn't listen to heavy metal music. You couldn't do this. You couldn't do that.
And now you do it all.
I do it all. I did it all. And I'm fine. So are most of the people. And they'll probably be fine in the future.
Okay. All right.
I didn't know about this masturbation.
All right. Thank you. How did that get in there?
I mean, really? You're alone. Who's going to know?
All right. Here is Bill in Detroit. Bill, thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. You are on the air with Peter and Jalene. Go ahead.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I just wanted to speak about the marijuana situation in Michigan. I'm from Detroit.
Sure. Yeah.
I went to Ashbath last year. It was very, very nice. Everyone was smoking. No police had a problem. They were right there. I mean, I think I was 100 feet from two or three police officers, and we were smoking.
So I was wrong. I mean, because
were you on the Diag?
We were around the big structure, the building. I don't know what that is.
In the middle of the U of M campus?
The Diag.
Yeah. But so, you know, what we always used to traditionally do forever, you know, is tell people, you know, be sure you don't smoke on the U of M campus because that's state law. But you're saying, no, oh, they don't even bother you now. But how many people you think were there? How many people in the town?
Oh, 10,000.
Oh, 10,000. Wow.
Like you said, or maybe even more, maybe.
But you know what, Bill? When you're high, sometimes things look a little bigger than they really are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to comment on the one caller that talked about how marijuana is more stronger now and blah, 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 and kids, and we've got to keep it away from our kids. I don't think people realize that when we keep it illegal and it's more attainable by kids than ever.
Yeah.
That's true.
When it's illegal.
Yeah, like in Colorado, if it's legal, you have to show your ID, right?
Yeah. You know,
is that what you're saying?
I was just at somebody's house I know, and the guy's son came in. He's an adult, you know, and he said, hey, Dad, it's 420.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that means it's time,
right.
Time to burn one.
Code.
So, what do they say? That... families that get high together stay together.
Is that true?
I don't know.
Is that what they say?
I don't know. I think.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Back in the 50s, they used to say families that pray together stay together.
Yeah.
But now it's a new century. All right, Bill, hey, thanks for joining us. Some open lines for you. I was saying a little earlier about the Republicans trying to restrict voting. Hey, can you believe this, Jalene? Would you believe if I said I was going to give a positive shout-out to Republicans?
I'm sure it's twisted in some way.
It is not. It actually is not. I hear, I don't know if you were looking at our email, at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and this is Republican Party and Marriage. So I thought it was going to really be a trounce. Because, as we know, that the Michigan constitutional prohibition against same-sex marriage was overturned by Judge Friedman last week, but because of the intervention of the Republican Attorney General.
They appealed,
and it's on hold. But
well, the good news is that on a federal level, Eric Holder said that the 300 or so couples that have married, that did it last Saturday, or a week ago, Saturday, that they are they're cool. They don't have to wait. They're free to be married and get all the benefits from that.
Okay, the shout-out for the Republicans. Angela sent this in to us, and this it's addressed to me directly. It's a press release, and it's from Young Conservatives for the Freedom to Marry. Even they have caught they've caught the message, right? Recent polls show record levels of support for the freedom to marry. This surge in support is only possible due to a major shift in Republican attitudes on marriage for gay couples. You know, I don't think they've shifted that much. I think really who has shifted is Democratic voters. Because when this was voted in, and I always forget, was it 2004 or 2006?
Yeah. Four.
Yeah, because that's the Republicans wanted to bring people. Well, they lost Michigan, but so Democrats voted for John Kerry in 2004. But the majority of people, which must have been including the majority of Democrats or great numbers of them, voted for this constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. So I'm sorry, I'm not trying to take it away from you, Angela. I think there has been a shift in what she said.
I'm surprised there's still young conservatives.
Yeah,
I think the only reason that is because of their parents. It's got to be. You young conservatives, tell me how you got to be that way.
Well, 60% of Republicans and Republican leaners under 30 support the freedom to marriage. So they're consistent with people, they're young, millennials, as
right.
they call them. Well, I think, and what you see here, is they like this libertarian strain. Mm-hmm. Which on one hand...
Strain.
What could you call it?
No, I like strain.
Yeah,
it works.
All right. That, so, you know, the Ron and Rand Paul thing that, you know, they're opposed to military intervention. They have freedom to marry. They're against drug laws. What else? Stuff like that.
Close all the bases.
Yeah. And lots of them defend a woman's right to choose, but not Rand Paul and not Ron Paul. So they don't want
to. So they draw the line when it comes to my hoo-ha.
Well, that's the old ones. Right. Well, they want to. Yeah, you did say that. Your hoo-ha, right? Well, they don't want to lead. They don't want to lose the real base of the Republican Party, these angry, repressive, controlling.
Right.
Authoritarian.
Yeah, so the one topic they choose is.
And on the other hand, they're terrible
My
on
body.
Things that have to do with economics, but we can talk about that. All right, Angela, good. That's a cool thing. All right. Okay, and Jalene put out the question, how did you get to be a Republican?
Especially if you're under 30.
Yeah, or a millennial. I don't even, what does
so
that
what
mean?
So what gives?
Yeah, what's up with
really?
That?
Really?
But here's what the Republicans are up to now. Pivotal swing states under Republican control are embracing significant new electoral restrictions on registering and voting that go beyond the voter identification requirements. The bill's laws and administrative rules shake up fundamental components of state election systems, including the days and time polls are open and the locations where people vote. In other words, the Republicans are trying to restrict voting to as much as possible. Because they
keep people
know,
away from the polls.
Yeah, because it's interesting that, I mean, for a whole lot of reasons, some good, some understandable, some bad, a lot of people that are farther down the economic ladder are less motivated to vote. Because one thing about these teabaggers, one thing about these righties, they are like a dog on a bone.
Well, you know, the thing
they
is,
show up.
When it comes to those that demographic that you are talking about, first of all, they're probably working three jobs.
That's one of the things I meant. That's a good reason. Yeah,
they don't have time to take out. Maybe they don't have transportation.
Well, one of the things they're complaining about, that churches have caravans from their churches when the polls have been open on Sunday before election. Oh, how horrible. They're bringing people to vote. When were we just saying this last week? I don't know why the Democrats haven't said there should be a legal holiday on that Tuesday.
Absolutely.
And the argument would be it would cost the American economy $17 billion. Okay, have it. Early voting, or have it Saturday and Sunday, and what have you. This would benefit the Democratic Party. But
how about you're able to vote for an entire week?
Yeah, why not? I don't get it. But yeah. Republicans in Ohio and Wisconsin this winter pushed through measures limiting the time polls are open, in particular cutting into weekend voting favored by low-income voters. Oh, you don't want those low-income. I mean, that's like the democracy when everybody gets to vote.
Well, these people who are such haters probably think with low income comes, you know, that they're dumb, you know?
Well, they don't care whether they're smart or dumb. They know that they have a tendency to vote for their best economic interest. And although the Democrats are too beholden to corporations themselves, they're not 100% beholden to corporations the way the Republicans are. Nine states have passed measures making it harder to vote since the beginning of 2013. Think about this. The franchise, the vote, has been expanded. Boy, I use this phrase almost every week, don't we? From the beginning of the Republic, when it was white propertied males, and then it became unpropertied males, then it became that everybody could vote, including ex-slaves, then women could vote, right? And it was always a matter of expanding it. Then they had to fight segregation in the South, where talk about government killing people. Then it was, you know, sheriffs and people like that. Democrats and other critics of the laws say, these are the Republican laws, say in the face of shifting demographics, Republicans are trying to alter the rules and shape the electorate in their favor. Those most affected by the restrictions are minorities and the poor, who tend to vote Democratic. Huh. Last year, the Supreme Court struck down a central provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And what that did, it put all these southern states that were these segregationists under the supervision of the Justice Department. And this, the Supreme Court decision under the, you know, Republican conservative control, had a decision that allowed a number of mostly southern states to alter their election laws without the prior approval of the Justice Department. A few weeks later, free the mandate, and emboldened by a Republican supermajority, North Carolina passed the country's most sweeping restrictions on voting.
My gosh. So, as if it's not difficult enough as it is. They're going to make it more difficult.
The Republicans, anyways, are addicted to coke. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Okay. Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Now your whole family gets even more for less. Sign up for the More Everything plan from Verizon and share an amazing 10 gigabytes of data for just $45 monthly access per line when you sign up for four lines with Verizon Edge. Click the banner to learn more. Activation, early termination, and other fees may apply.
Baseball fans, text to win a 20-person suite to a Detroit baseball game. Just look for the Winner's Circle logo at participating Atlas Oil Supply gas stations. Once at your favorite Winner's Circle gas station, text to win. Code words can be found at the pumps. No purchase necessary. Participating stations and official rules at atlasoil.com. Listen for details on when WRIF will be at a Winner's Circle station near you. Check the Atlas Oil Facebook page for additional giveaways. Text to win the Detroit Baseball Suite, courtesy of Atlas Oil and its local Winner's Circle gas station owners.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely.
First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hey, had a request. Play this one again, Hash Bash, this coming Saturday.
All of my friends, we should be leaving town. And there really is better things to do than to be hanging around. We've got a date in a town named Michigan, and we're sending a protest wish again to all of those who still have ears, let them hear. Because we're going to the hash, and I'm a hash, and I'm a hash bash. We're going to see some folks, and man, we'll have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. And we'll see you there. Don't be late.
As is Saturday on the Michigan Diag, protests against marijuana laws in Michigan.
We haven't heard from Big B.
Where's Big B? He told me to play this. Yeah.
This is weak.
The group is Burning Incense, and the album
That's
is
funny.
Get Me High.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Got a lot of other. We should play these, too.
Are you going to go?
Nah.
Me neither. Yeah. I got an email from Kim, and she said, we were talking about voting. In Australia, you have to vote or you will be fined.
Yeah, that's true.
What do you think? She said we should do that. What do you think, Peter?
Actually, I don't like that. I would not vote.
I knew you wouldn't like that. Well, plus there are people who can't physically
get there. You can.
You should be able to do a mail-in thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And where they pay for the postage.
You can get out of it. They don't come around. I'm not even sure how they enforce it in Australia. But the United States has such a poor turnout as it is. And it could be, and it was increasing with these extended voting and early voting and extended hours.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the ways that Bush stole the election in 2004, he stole it in a different way in 2000. He had his buddies on the Supreme Court take care of it. But in 2004, where he actually won in Ohio, there was a lot of shenanigans, but one of it was creating these lines in Democratic districts where people had to wait for 4 and 5 hours. I mean, I would have gone home.
I waited a couple hours last big election. Yeah, I sure did.
Wow. I never wouldn't have done that.
I did it.
Yeah, well, good for you.
There was no way in hell they were getting me out of there.
But these are engineered in order to dissuade people from voting. If everybody voted, if everybody could just, like, vote, you wouldn't even hear the Republican Party. They would be gone.
Yeah, right.
They would be absolutely gone. So we were talking about how the Republicans are trying to restrict voting. When they get the reins of government in the states. All right, I'm interested to hear this. Here's Tom in Westland. Hey, Tom, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter and Jolene. How you doing?
Good. Thanks
Good
for calling.
I just wanted to answer Jolene's question about how a young person can be a Republican.
Yeah.
Well, when you're young and dumb, you're just kind of brainwashed into doing whatever your parents, basically do. And if your parents are Republican, then you're probably going to be one, too.
See, now that was my situation, but
yeah.
I escaped that madness.
Yeah, until you wake up and you do something on your, you get out there on your own, you find out what's really going on, then you might change your mind.
About
Like Jolene did, yeah, right. And
yeah,
you
start coming up, you start thinking on your own,
yeah.
And you start having your own thoughts and whatever.
Well,
so what are you saying? That's what happened to you?
For that.
Because you live in a predominantly working class union town of Westland, and to vote for a party that's a tool of the ultra rich billionaires doesn't make a lot of sense on the face of it to me.
No doubt. Yeah, it's like cutting your own nose off,
Oh, you're a green. You're a Green.
Yeah, he's a Green.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you are a young Republican.
No.
No. I used to be until I woke up.
Until you started thinking for yourself.
Until I found out what the hell was going on, and then I changed my mind.
Yeah.
It's like being a recovering Catholic.
Yeah. All right. Well, you folks got a great show there, and I appreciate you talking there.
All right, Tom. Thank you. Nice to hear from you
as
well.
And I'm happy for you.
And something went, sometimes these are not dropping. Yeah, there we go. Okay, I'm trying to, here. Nate from Waterford wants to know what the problem with showing voter ID is. Well, there's not a problem. That's the deal. A lot of times there's a lot of the poor that do not have access to ID, and it's partly intimidation, but why in the world would you want to require ID when there's not a problem? Nobody's going to be able to fix an election by individuals voting, and when the Republicans are ever asked to show where there are voting abuses, they can't come up with anything. Or they find one person that was voting in the wrong district, or one person took somebody else's ID, or went to vote for somebody else, and it turned out it wasn't that. There was no problem. This is just their rationalization. And, Nate, if you really think...
To keep people away from the polls.
If you really think that the Republicans are motivated by voter integrity, I just don't know what to tell you.
They own the... Diebold owns the machines that where all the...
Yeah.
Issues have occurred.
And particularly in Ohio in 2004.
And Florida.
Yeah.
With Florida hanging well. Chads.
Right. Okay. Here is here's Todd. Todd's in Madison Heights. Going to change the subject a little bit. That's fine. Go ahead, Todd. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Jillian.
Hi.
Awesome
Hi.
Show again. I wonder what your feelings on a governor not opening up his mouth and saving two dogs that were... two dogs were put down in Florida on Thursday due to a technicality.
What was it?
They supposedly bit a 13-year-old kid, but the kid was instigating the whole situation, and they were grabbed illegally from the house, and they were in prison for 2 years, but the judge... Uh-huh.
The dogs were...
Yeah, the dogs were in prison. Yeah. The city council and the judge would hear any appeals, and people were trying to contact the governor, and the governor wouldn't even make a phone call.
Governor Scott.
Yes.
Of Florida. Todd, without knowing more about it, I don't know what to say. I mean, there is a tendency when dogs...
I love that you are so
concerned
yeah. about animals, because Peter and I are the same way.
Yeah.
Because it's coming, it's hitting us up here. And if we don't change it, dogs are continuously get shot, be grabbed for no reason, and they don't even know which dog bit the kid. So they get both dogs and put them both down.
Well, you know, Todd, it is, there's injustice to be sure. And what is necessary is to be more and more alert. I mean, there's to it, not just let it happen. And I'd actually, if you got information on it, send it to us, okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Appreciate your call. Here is David. David's in Detroit. David, hi. You're on the air.
Peter, I can't take it anymore.
Oh, no.
I've been listening to this, and I thought with the Obamacare thing and that we need single payer and that it's all going to work out, I thought, all right, bite your tongue. And then when I heard a little bit more, I bit my tongue. But when that last caller called in about how young Republicans are formed, I just couldn't take it anymore.
Okay.
This is how Democrats are formed. They don't think. They don't think for themselves. The kids follow what the professors indoctrinate them with. And then they go, and then they start thinking for themselves. I'm going with it. And then they start thinking for themselves. And I think this is where libertarianism comes in. I think people start thinking for themselves. They want to do for themselves. They stop looking to the status in government. And don't kid yourselves, folks. It isn't just the Republicans. There are status in the progressive movement, in the Democrat movement. They are just as bad, if not worse, in some cases. I've seen it. I've been around it long enough. So I think when everybody grows up, they will become libertarian, and I'm starting to see that really take root.
That's a little bit self, what is it, Peter?
Congratulatory?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you.
Because you're doing exactly what you're accusing all these other people of doing by saying what you just said. Do you realize that?
So libertarians, I mean, listen, funny. I want to be thankful for all the leftists and liberal socialist professors that I had in school, because they were wonderful. They got me thinking creatively. They got me critically thinking. Are there ideologues? Are there people whose thinking is ossified because of political ideology? You bet, among leftists, to be sure. But there is nothing more authoritarian and rigid than the authoritarian right-wing mind. Or maybe it's wrong. I mean, well, one of the things that influenced me the most was, you ever hear of a early psychologist named Wilhelm Reich?
Yes.
Okay. He actually was extraordinarily critical, first of fascism. He was active in the 1930s, 1940s, particularly. But then he also became understood that it wasn't just left and right, but it was authoritarian mindset. And he became, obviously very critical of Stalinism and that kind of same, patriarchal, top-down, father figure, you do what as I say, mentality and emotion set that allows authoritarian governments to rule people without them making a peep, and to idolize people that are repressing them, to be sure. So whenever I wind up with, even a vague defense of like the Maduro government or Obama or back in the day Central American government that were under attack, I go, ooh, I feel a little uncomfortable doing that. But let me just say quickly, libertarians have a good, like this woman that wrote just about marriage equality, but and drugs. And, the Pauls don't want the U.S. Fighting
military,
wars
yeah.
all across the world. But when you get down to the nitty of the economy, they're back in the 19th century, and they would guarantee, when you have capitalism, it has to be rigidly controlled by the state, or it's going to wind up just like the 19th century.
I'm curious what your response is, David.
He's
waiting for it.
No, I'm listening. Yeah. I just didn't want to interrupt. I wanted to complete your thought. So insofar as the economy goes, again, I'm libertarian small L. I don't follow the party. I don't agree with these parties. It's just the idea of your individual liberty. I'm for individualism, not collectivism. And I think between the two parties and the status that control it, you're talking about the collectivist mindset, that the sum total of the greater whole is more important than the individual. I'll never buy into that.
That's just Randite rhetoric. I mean, sorry to be rude and what have you. There is something where we have a collective interest in performing together socially, like on my block, in our little city and what have you. And do I want to be run by a collective bureaucracy? Well, of course not. Nobody wants to do that except for people that are, have authoritarian mindset. But there is a tension, but not necessarily a contradiction between the collective and between the individual. And individualism usually means to me, and I know some people want to defend selfishness, but selfishness is absolutely what's wrong with this world.
Well, I'm not talking about selfishness in the sense of that there's no charity or you don't help your fellow man. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the force of government and writing law for the collective. It's impossible to write a one-size-fits-all law for every individual because every individual has different needs, different wants, different desires.
Well, how do you deal with corporations when they like Target? I don't want to give them the wrong. I had a story here. I can't remember, but I think it was Target.
Target
that's being sued by these women because they were paying unequal wages, or the fact that that employers used to work kids 14 hours a day, or that they had unsafe working conditions, or that they would pay people $3 an hour. I mean, if it wasn't for the government and unions, and you're a union member, and I'm a union member, it wasn't for unions artificially raising the price of labor or a standard, we'd all be working, particularly now, for $2 an hour. That's the market.
Well, I think, too, that you've got to take a look at the fact that if you've got people that are willing to go into those stores and purchase and support that business, there's your problem. I mean, with competition, you can take a look at other corporations that compete with Target, and if people see what's going on with Target, they can choose to go to another corporation or smaller business
buy
even better
local.
And not support them.
Well, they don't do that, though. People, that's why there had to be, people had no option except to work under the conditions that a company, a boss, a corporation dealt to them before unions. And Roosevelt and the progressive capitalists that he represented understood that we were looking at the possibility of a revolution here. And we better get some guarantees in place for the average American citizen. We're going back
to... Or the S might hit the fan.
Yeah, exactly. So, I'm not like a huge fan of Roosevelt either. But, the idea there'd be no Social Security, no Medicare, no Medicaid, when you have such... When capitalism creates such disparities of wealth, if you don't support people, then you better start sharing the wealth equally. And then if you're going to do that, you can only do it through the apparatus of the state.
You can't blame capitalism for the greed of man. I mean, that's, capitalism is just, I create something. There's a need for something. I create it. You want it. You buy it. Or you create something and we trade or whatever. I mean, that's just a simple logic of capitalism. Well, you're talking about cronyism.
Well, that's what it's all devolved down into. I mean, capitalism now is mostly just speculation and producing commodities overseas at with cheap labor and paying people here. I mean, what's going to happen eventually that the wages in China, because there's all sorts of strikes and labor actions and what have you, all of a sudden they'll say, hey, wait a minute. We'll get a Republican in there and we'll get rid of the minimum wage, or we'll get a sub minimum wage, and it'll be about $5 an hour. And gee, with the transportation costs, we can start bringing industry back to the United States, and then that'll happen, and then people will start joining unions again and saying we want $10 an hour, and then the capitalists will say, oh, we got to take our business to Africa where we can get cheap labor.
Well, how about this? You want a pay raise, because I know Obama's coming here on Wednesday, and the message I would convey is if you want a pay raise, how about stop printing money off the presses faster than we can produce things? How about quit taxing the middle class and the poor so that their money can't go very far and that they need more money to spend? I don't think it's the volume of money that's the issue. It's the fact that it's worthless because government just is allowed to print it at will.
Well, it works pretty well. I mean, there's not inflation or anything like that. And I certainly think I've always advocated a $50,000 tax deduction right off the top and shift. I mean, when you start, I don't know. I don't even know what wait a minute. Let me just see if I can quickly get this. I mean, Coca-Cola, do I have this? Coca-Cola is going to allocate over the next 4 years $24 billion in proposed compensation plans for their executive. And this one, David Winters, a longtime money manager and founder of Wintergreen Advisors, he says, I couldn't believe it. He said we can find no responsible basis for gifting management almost 15% of the share capital of Coca-Cola worth $24 billion at today's stock prices. So you have, on the other side of things, people asking, to get $10.10 an hour. Something is out of whack. But
they need to take those billions and give it to the workers.
Yeah. David, give me a real quick headline. Sum up, because I got to go. You get the last word.
This is a rarity. Take advantage of it.
Yeah.
I don't think I could and make it sound very good in a few sentences. I'll just say that it's always good to talk to the folks, the two of you. You do a nice job, and we'll just agree to disagree on certain subjects, but it's good to engage.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate you calling in. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're getting towards the end of the show, and if I can bring my website up. We haven't even talked about this much. Facebook is there. We'll have our show as a podcast available at noon today, so that's in about 11 hours. Jefferson going to take care of it on this end, and on the other end,
Jeremy
is going to be doing it, and we appreciate it. And I'm going to be interviewing
him. And then
Then
there's me.
Then there's you, too. She will post it by noon. Alice
We're
Slater.
Just such an old, not married couple, Peter. Leave me out of it.
Alice Slater, who is the New York director of Abolition 2000, is going to be talking about the threat from the 17,000 nuclear weapons that still exist in the world, 16,000 of them possessed by the United States and Russia. And a lot of them are on instant alert still. That's not too good. Marion Nestle, who's the author of Eat, Drink, and Vote, is going to talk about food politics and how that determines what we eat and ultimately what our health
is
all about.
Yeah. And I would like to say, even though this is a local show, so I'm going to say have a great opening day to all
today.
You Tigers fans. Go Tigers. And for those of you who don't... It's the Detroit Tigers. It's baseball. It's here in Detroit. It's really big.
Yeah. Big old tailgating tomorrow. I think I'm going to head down there.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, you're such a man about town.
I am indeed.
You know where I'll be?
Where? In bed.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. But then she's going to get up and post the podcast.
Yeah.
All right, Jefferson, thank you very much for doing the phones, and thanks to all of you for listening and calling, and we got another one next week.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
This is your Car Care Minute. Drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. Look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Every hour is happy hour.
Everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Those of you who are a little older may remember that great period of the nuke fear when the Cold War was raging between the Soviet Union and the United States. Missiles poised at one another, nuclear tipped, the capacity to destroy both nations, maybe things like Dr. Strangelove. Even no matter how old you are, you should see that film. The talk about mutually assured destruction. That was the governing policy way back then. Mad. I mean, think of how insane that is to call a military policy mad. Mutually assured destruction. But bam, the Soviet Union disintegrates. The Cold War is over. Kind of coming back a little now, isn't it? But no more nuke fear. Or should there be? Well, President Obama right now, as we record this on Tuesday, March 24th, is at The Hague in the Netherlands at a nuclear security summit, although he's been mostly talking about Crimea and also NSA spying, which he says is going to stop. But is there still a problem with nukes? Should we still have nuke fear? Well, you say, oh, yeah, what about North Korea? What about Iran? Well, let's bring to the microphone someone who speaks to all of those issues, and she is Alice Slater. She's the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and serves on the coordinating committee of Abolition 2000. Their website is abolition2000.org, and we're reaching her at her office in New York City. Alice Slater, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
I'm delighted to be here.
Now, one of the things that I was looking at is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation was founded in 1982, so we're above 30 years later. Things have gotten any better since then or worse or stayed the same?
I think they've stayed the same. Well, right now we're sort of in a worse period because of the bad feeling between the U.S. and Russia, but we still have 17,000 nuclear bombs on the planet, and 16,000 of them are in the U.S. and Russia. And we still have about 2,500 pointed at each other on hair trigger alert, targeting all our cities. So we've never really given up that old Cold War posture, which is insane. And when I say 16,000 in the U.S. and Russia, that means all the other countries that have nuclear weapons have 1,000 altogether, and I'll name them for you. It's England, France, China, Israel, Pakistan, India, and now North Korea got some recently. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. They don't want them, they say. But the fact is that anybody that has a nuclear reactor for peaceful nuclear power really has a bomb factory, because that's how you get the material to make a bomb from a nuclear reactor, and we're spreading that around the world, too. So what Obama's doing right now in The Hague, they're trying to lock down the reactor material, the highly enriched research reactor material that can make bombs, and they're trying to store it and guard it and put it in one place and do something with it. But it's almost, if anybody remembers the Disney movie Fantasia with the Sorcerer's Apprentice, where every time he's trying to clean it out, it gets to be more and more.
Yeah.
If we keep doing nuclear power, we're constantly creating the potential for bomb material.
You know, Alice Slater, as an activist in trying to bring about nuclear disarmament, I think you probably have said the first part of your answer any number of times. But I think people ought to just sit back for a sec and think about that again. 17,000 nuclear weapons. One, look what it did to Hiroshima. And two, look what it did to Nagasaki. And the fact that we have thousands of them pointed at us from Russia and ours pointed at Russia ought to be, you know, pretty, well, frightening, I guess is the word, but I don't think it's in too many people's consciousness. I doubt if you said, are you afraid of a nuclear exchange? They probably, unless they brought up Iran, and I think it's not on anybody's mind to speak of. Do you think that's true?
You know, I don't think there would be a deliberate nuclear exchange, but we have come so close. I have saved a copy of the congressional record when the Congress was negotiating to end nuclear underground tests. there were 34 airplanes flying with nuclear bombs that crashed, and they luckily never went off. Two of them spewed a little plutonium in Thule, Greenland, and in Palomares, Spain. One is off the coast of Georgia. They never found it. And we're just pushing our luck. I mean, just the last year, there was a big story. I don't know if your listeners caught it in the news in America, that a plane carrying nuclear-loaded missiles flew by mistake from North Dakota to Mississippi. They didn't know they hadn't taken the bombs off the missiles. And then there were a couple of stories recently about the guys that sit in the bunker with their hand on the nuclear button watching for an attack were drunk or they cheated on their tests. I mean, there's been like a lot of crazy stuff that we should not be tolerating.
But, you know, back in here is maybe the argument against what you just said. We've had these weapons and had them on hair triggers since the 1950s or even the late 1940s when you think about just B-52 bombers with them. And there's been some mishaps, as you laid out, but it hasn't happened. And so maybe Alice Slater and the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, Abolition 2000, are chicken littles. The sky hasn't ever fallen.
Well, but the sky doesn't fall. But, I mean, nuclear bombs do go off. We've just been lucky. I mean, there's no reason to put ourselves in that kind of hazard. And aside from the risks of it, which are, it's nuts to be living under that kind of risk when we've never used them. They're so horrible. I mean, 140,000 people were killed with one bomb in Hiroshima. We've never used them. You know, so why are we still keeping them? And not only are we not using them, but we are going to spend like over $180 billion in the next 10 years for two new bomb factories at Los Alamos and Kansas City, Kansas, and for new submarines, missiles, and airplanes that can deliver nuclear weapons. I mean, when you think of what the people of Detroit are going through with their needs for infrastructure, for education, to waste that kind of money, I mean, what could it stop? It could not have stopped a terrorist hitting the World Trade Center. I mean, a nuclear bomb is useless.
Now, in you have an article called Time for a 21st Century U.S. Foreign Policy that was in commondreams.org the last day or so. And in there it says that we are planning to spend $640 billion. You said a much lower figure there. I was astounded.
I think that was for 1 year. I'm sorry. That was the 10-year plan is $640 billion.
Yeah. Two new bomb factories, new lethal delivery systems, including missiles, planes, and submarines. Well, one could make the argument when we're facing a hostile world and hostilities ramping up with Russia, China. They always say on the march. What they call rogue states like North Korea. The fear that Iran may have a nuclear weapon. Can't the argument be made that we need that as a deterrent?
I think that's what they tell us to scare us, and I think that our Congress has bought that the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned against. I mean, he was the general of that one World War II in Europe, and our president said we have to look out for this military-industrial complex. They're pushing it on us. They're stoking the fears. I mean, when I read the mainstream media lately, it makes me cry because nobody's getting the true story about Russia. I mean, when the wall came down in 1990 or whatever it was, Gorbachev was like a saint. He let go of all of Eastern Europe without a shot. I mean, all those years, those countries were subjugated under the Soviet Union, and he let them all go free and form their own democratic governments. And they were terrified of Germany because Russia lost 20 million people during World War II from the Nazi onslaught. But we promised them that if they didn't object to a unified Germany coming into NATO, our military alliance, we would not expand NATO. And this has been written and talked about a number of times by Jack Matlock, who was the ambassador to Russia under Reagan and Bush. This is not some liberal fantasy. I mean, this is what we told Gorbachev. Well, we took all of Eastern Europe into NATO, and we actually are talking about taking Ukraine and Georgia in, and that's where the trouble's coming. Then the other thing is...
We should tell people that we're talking about the country of Georgia, not that southern state.
Yeah, that was part of the Soviet Union, and it's right near Moscow. I mean, it's like, what would we think if the Russians did a military alliance with Canada and Mexico? That's what we're up to. I mean, we know what happened when they put missiles in Cuba. We went bananas till we got them out of there. And by the way, part of the deal that Kennedy made with Khrushchev to get the missiles out of Cuba, and it was secret because he wouldn't have been able to sell it to the hawks in America, was that we would get our missiles out of Turkey, which we did later, like a year later, quietly. We didn't announce it as part of the deal. This has come out later. And now we put missiles back in Turkey and in Poland and in Romania, right next to Russia. We are a bully, really. We're bullying them. And
we should say that this term bully, which Alice Slater has enunciated, is also the words of Jack Matlock, the Reagan and Bush One ambassador to Russia. Alice Slater is the New York director of the Nuclear Peace Foundation, serves on the coordinating committee of Abolition 2000. A good web address is abolition2000.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. One of the things we should examine, and it's very good that you bring up this question of NATO and NATO moving eastward. NATO has kind of become a proper noun, but it obviously stands for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and was set as a hedge against the Warsaw Pact, the Eastern European Soviet-dominated countries way back. So a lot of these countries in Eastern Europe are certainly not part of any North Atlantic. They're in the heartland. They're on the road to Moscow in a way. So I don't think we want to make Putin or the Russians out as the good guys. But as you said with your analogy, if Russia had military treaties with Canada and let alone Cuba. Say they forget about the big ones. What if they just started that with Cuba? I mean, so tell us about what you think Russian fears are from NATO.
Well, first of all, it's not just NATO where we've taken, you know, all of Europe is in NATO. Gorbachev said, well, let us join NATO. I mean, if we wanted a military alliance in Europe, why didn't we let Russia be part of NATO at that point? They were totally giving up the confrontation between East and West when the Soviet Union dissolved. But NATO, it's not just NATO. We had a treaty with Russia that we signed in 1972, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. We were building up so many nuclear weapons. I mean, now I'm telling you there's 18,000 on the planet, but there used to be over 30,000. So we have been cutting them, although the difference between 30 and 17 doesn't really make any difference when you think what one nuclear bomb can do.
Sure.
But anyway, we had a treaty with Russia where we promised not to build anti-missiles because the missile buildup was so huge that we were bankrupting each other. So we said, okay, we make a deal. We're not going to build anti-missiles, and then we could just stay at the inventory of our missiles. And that was in 72. And Clinton started building the infrastructure in Poland and Romania to put anti-missiles in. And Putin offered Clinton, let's cut, at that time maybe there were 26,000 nuclear weapons in the U.S. and Russia, let's cut our arsenals to 1,000 bombs each and don't put missiles in Poland and Romania. And Clinton blew him off, and Putin took that offer off the table, which would have, if the U.S. and Russia would have cut to 1,000 bombs each, then we could call everybody to the table, China, France, England, you know, the others, and negotiate a treaty to ban the bomb, like we've banned chemical and biological weapons. But Clinton didn't go along, and then Bush actually just walked out of the ABM treaty and said, we're not going to be part of it, and now we're ringing Russia with missiles in Turkey, where we promised to take them out.
50 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and we put new ones back in, and in Poland and Romania, and we're also pivoting to the east. We're beefing up our missiles with Japan and with South Korea. We're giving China a hard time. And our military documents, I mean, like the U.S. Space Command says that our mission is, and I'm going to quote it, dominating and protecting the military use of space to protect, dominating and controlling the military use of space to protect U.S. interests and investments. And this says it in the U.S. Space Command document, Vision 2020. They're not even embarrassed to say that we want to dominate the world. And even with the cyber warfare that we're hearing about now, which is really creepy because, you know, it's hard to get a nuclear weapon, but any computer nerd can attack our electricity system or our transportation systems, you know, with cyber attacks. We did the first cyber attack on the uranium enrichment plant where we thought they were enriching uranium to make it weapons grade, although they denied that's what they were doing. They said they were just doing it for their civilian program. And we boasted about it. And then Putin asked Obama, why don't we negotiate a cyber warfare treaty not to engage in this and to set up some rules? And we blew him off. So the way I look at our country right now, we're like a baby hiding under covers, playing peekaboo, and thinking that we can do all this stuff, and because we can't see other people, they don't see us.
Hmm. Well, Al Slater, let me just put this to you. I could imagine someone listening and saying, Al Slater is hopelessly naive. We live in a hostile world, and if the United States doesn't dominate the world, we're going to wind up being dominated by our, quote, enemies, Russia or China in particular. And then there are these rogue states, North Korea, potentially Iran. And actually, if we didn't have this position of great strength, one of my neighbors has a bumper sticker that says, peace, or how does she... peace through military superiority. This is what's operational. You can't mess with us because we are the biggest of all, and this assures peace. What you're suggesting is what the Republicans are always talking about, weakness, and that would actually encourage aggression.
Well, I think we just have to have a little common sense here. Certainly, we don't want to be vulnerable to any attack. But if you think that spending $680 billion on new nuclear weapons is going to save you from the guys with box cutters that flew a plane into the building, I mean, let's be sensible. And if you don't want to have those kind of people gunning for you, if you took the $680 billion and did something what America's supposed to do, like really good foreign aid, we'll first start in our own country and help our own poor people. But do you imagine right now Obama is sitting in his office every week with two guys from CIA and NSA and picking out who they're going to kill on the ground with drones. He's the judge, the jury, the executioner. There's no evidence. There's no trial. He just sends out the orders and they kill people on the ground. And they turns out, you hear, they killed a wedding party or they killed some children or they, I mean, we're making enemies all over the world. What kind of a policy is that? If America could be the greatest, we could be the greatest light of democracy and help and genuine aid, but we're not. We've been in three wars, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. I mean, they hate us. Mm. We're just stirring up a hornet's nest. You want to be safe? Bring some of those troops back. Stop spending all that. I mean, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a defense force, but I mean, we're spending more than the rest of the world combined.
Sure. Ella Slater is my guest, and she serves on the coordinating committee of Abolition 2000 about abolishing all nuclear weapons. Their website is abolition2000.org. She's just written an article called Time for a 21st Century U.S. Foreign Policy. It's at commondreams.org. And in it, you advocate the disbanding of NATO. Tell us about that, and what do you think the consequences would be?
Well, it's a Cold War military alliance. Who is NATO fighting? I mean, Russia's not on to fight Eastern Europe. Who is NATO fighting? I mean, they don't. We should be going back to the original vision at 1945 when we formed the United Nations. If we didn't have it, we'd have to reinvent it. we should fix the institution that if we do need global peacekeeping, it's global, and it goes through the Security Council without a veto or a two-thirds vote in the General Assembly. If people think there's a need for a military force to stop some kind of havoc that's going on in the world. But, you know, NATO is an old Cold War, rusty military 20th century alliance. And it's getting us into trouble because that's why Putin walked into Crimea. I'm not excusing him. I mean, it's terrible that he did that. But he was also he felt that's their warm water seaport. They've been there for years. Crimea was part of Russia until 1954. Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine, but that was still all in the Soviet Union. But to have it in our military alliance when we don't allow Russia to be in our alliance. If we want NATO, then Russia should be in the alliance. I mean, we shouldn't be in a hostile position towards them. And the other thing is that people don't know. I wish everybody knew this. Russia and China proposed at the UN in the Commission on Disarmament in Geneva that the world negotiate a treaty to keep weapons out of space and these missiles that are part of the space infrastructure. And every country in the world voted for it, and we blocked it because you need a consensus at the Commission on Disarmament. You need 100% in favor to go forward. The U.S. stopped it like 3 or 4 years in a row. They wanted to do that. And so when we say we have to have this because what are we going to do about China or Russia? China says, let's get rid of nuclear weapons. They're on the record, you know.
Yeah, you know, we're coming to the end of our interview, and I wonder, because one of the organizations you work with, you are the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, it's over 30 years old, and I asked you at the beginning whether you thought progress had been made. Here's formulating the same question, but in a different way. Are you hopeful at all? It seems sometimes not very much to me, because we have to... get a consciousness among the American people, and that has to be even harder translated into policy. And we are stuck, locked into a 20th century foreign policy, whereas you advocate, let's get into this one. What are your hopes for this?
I am very hopeful, even despite all the gloomy things I've told everyone. Of course, this week is particularly rough because of the Crimea. You know, that shifted something. But I think it was a miracle that America didn't bomb Syria. I mean, there was so much grassroots pressure from the right, from the left, from the middle. It wasn't a liberal thing. And then we beat back this amendment that the right-wing AIPAC, you know, supporters wanted to put more sanctions on Iran while we were talking to them. I mean, it's a miracle we're talking to Iran. We threw over their democratically elected president in 1953, a CIA assassinated Mossadegh. Then we put in the Shah that was like Hitler, and they overthrew him, and we wound up with the fanatical Ayatollah, I mean, but you get what you ask for in a way. And now we're sort of ratcheting it back, and it's great, and we shouldn't be having a Congress enacting new sanctions while they're sitting at the table talking about controlling their nuclear programs. So we stopped that. So I think the American people are wising up, and they're also getting that, you know, we don't have the money for this, and we have to make wise choices. We should never be undefended, but we are, like, over the top. We certainly don't need space weapons, because you have the major other powers, like Russia and China, willing to negotiate a treaty for no weapons in space. Why would we want to have a space race? It's like we're racing with ourselves, or cyber warfare. They're willing to talk about it. Now we're going to be ratcheting up billions of dollars to prevent cyber attacks instead of sitting down with the rest of the world and figuring out cooperatively how we can prevent it and getting everybody's cooperate. We're like a lone wolf. It's kind of like the Wild West. We're still the Wild West. Hmm. We're still a young country, you know.
I often use a quote from Napoleon, and what he once he said, that the only thing you cannot do with bayonets is sit on them. So the idea that if all weapons that have ever been developed have been used, and it's been a half-century battle on the part of people to abolish them. One of the groups in the forefront of it is the Coordinating Committee of Abolition 2000. My guest, Alice Slater, works with them. Abolition2000.org, Nuclear Age Peace Foundation is at wagingpeace.org. All of these links can be found on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Alice Slater, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
Have you ever thought about advertising on the roof?
Think it's too expensive or not the right fit for your business?
Or just looking to expand your digital marketing or event this year?
Let us show you how Riff can bring business directly to you. Call me, Paul Andino, at 248-591-6830 or click the banner ad now to email me directly.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
When I grow up, I want to be a glass countertop in a new home.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's best birthday present.
When I grow up, I want to be a football stadium.
When I grow up, I want to be a warm place on a cold day.
When I grow up, I want to be a fancy backsplash.
I want to be a bike that races around the country.
When I grow up, I want to be a bench on a forest trail.
When I grow up, I want to be a rocking chair on
when
a sunny porch.
I want to be a skyscraper.
I want to be a...
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 When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. A public service advertisement brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
During these tough economic times when many families are living paycheck to paycheck, it can be easy to lose sight of the importance of saving for the future. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants you to know there are some simple steps you can take to set aside dollars each month for retirement, college tuition, or unexpected expenses that could come your way. Most important is to review all your expenses and establish a monthly budget. Then examine every spending category and cut 10% from each. You can't reduce fixed expenses like rent or mortgage or a car payment, but you can easily cut back in many other areas, like entertainment, or using mass transit when possible instead of driving. And take a look at trying to bundle services such as your cell phone, land phone, cable TV, and internet service. For more tips and to speak with a certified credit counselor who can start you on the right track, call the NFCC at 800-388-2227 or visit debtadvice.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How'd you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out. But between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Yeah, I used to, well, I can even name the bar, the Old Miami in downtown Detroit. A lot of great bands have played there in the past and continue to do so. Nice, vibrant part of the Detroit scene. But for a long time, it was primarily a vets bar, veterans from the Vietnam War. And one of the slogans they had on the wall, was, "The war was wrong, not the warriors." These were men that came to oppose the war in which they fought, the Vietnam War. I think many of you, or at least some of you, may know of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Probably the most prominent member that is well known to all is Senator John Kerry, who threw his medals back at the White House in the Pentagon, that so disgusted were they with the war and its conduct. One of the things that one does not do publicly is to criticize the warriors, our troops, our boys. Maybe we can criticize George Bush or Richard Nixon or President Johnson, but we do not criticize our troops. That's sort of fundamental because ultimately they're doing their job. A book has come my way that's extraordinarily disturbing, and that has to do with the conduct of the war in Vietnam that was done by our troops. I was shocked to learn that there is a, in the Pentagon, there was a Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. This is absolutely extraordinary. The book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, and the author is Nick Terse. And Nick Terse is the author of The Complex. He's also the managing editor for TomDispatch.com, which I would highly recommend. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute, and his work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, The Nation, lots of other publications as well. His investigations of American, get this phrase now, folks, war crimes in Vietnam has gained him a Rittenhour Prize for Repertorial Distinction, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a fellowship at Harvard University's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. We're reaching him at his home near New York City. Nick Terse, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm sure you probably agree with everything I said. One does not talk about American soldiers and war crimes. That's what they do. But tell us about the Rittenhour Prize, and I assume that was named after Ron Rittenhour, and his positioning in all of this. I think that will make a lot more sense to people.
Sure. You know, Ron Rittenhour was he was a GI in Vietnam, and you know, he went to war with a group of men. They all trained together in Hawaii before they went to Vietnam. They were in the 23rd Infantry Division. And along the way, the infantry unit that Ron was in was split up, and he went off to serve as a crewman on a helicopter. And the rest of the GIs that he's was trained with went to serve as regular line infantry in the Vietnamese countryside. And this was the unit that eventually went into the village of My Lai, and on March 16th, 1968, they carried out the most notorious American war crime of the war. They killed more than 500 civilians, women, children, and old men over the course of several hours at My Lai. And in the months afterwards, you know, these guys came in from the field, and Ron Rittenhour was back at base camp, and he began talking with his old friends. And one by one, they would each say to him something along the lines of, "Did you hear, you know, what we did in that village?" They called it Pinkville. And Ron said no, and they would fill him in on what they'd seen. And once Ron heard this, you know, he was really shocked at what happened, and he began collecting testimony, because he said that if he did nothing, he would be complicit with what they had done. He didn't think it was right, and he thought it was important that this be investigated and proper criminal action taken against those who are responsible. So when Ron came back to the United States, he began writing letters, and he sent registered letters to 30 Washington, D.C. power brokers, members of Congress, high-ranking members of the military, even to the White House. And an investigation started, and eventually this investigation tipped off the investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. People may know today, still works at the New Yorker magazine. He's still breaking national security stories, but at the time he was basically a unknown Pentagon reporter. And Cy Hersh and Ron Rittenhour together were able to blow the lid off the My Lai massacre. And about a year after the massacre had been committed, a year and a half, it finally hit the front pages of America's papers.
And people were shocked. People said, this is not what the American troops do. This was
as it was called, Bad Apples. There was even a trial. Lieutenant Kelly and others were tried for it. So it was it was dealt with in the minds of many people. But please speak to that. But also, I'm just shocked to learn that the Pentagon actually had something called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. Well, kind of if you could weave maybe those answer to that in those elements in together.
Sure. Well, when the Pentagon began investigating the My Lai massacre, they put together a panel, which, you know, the basic idea was that this panel would thoroughly investigate My Lai. It would show that the massacre at My Lai was an aberration, that it was carried out by, somehow a rogue unit, something like that. This was the thought. And they convened a panel under the direction of a general by the name of Pierce. So it was called the Pierce Panel. And what General Pierce found really caused a great stir at the Pentagon, because during his investigation, which was astonishingly thorough, he found that there was another massacre committed on the same day as My Lai in a village called My Kay, not very far away. But it was carried out by an entirely different unit that had nothing to do with the operation going on at My Lai. I mean, they were complementary operations, but totally different troops involved. So this put the lie to the idea that My Lai was some sort of isolated incident. If two massacres could be going on in different places, but at the same time carried out by different troops, it really destroyed the Pentagon's narrative. And eventually the My Kay case was covered up. It was buried. All the charges in that were dropped, and the case sort of disappeared. At the same time, the military was really afraid that if this was the case, if they could look and at one discrete area of Vietnam and find two massacres on the same day, what else might be out there? So they created this secret Pentagon task force. It was run out of the Army Chief of Staff's office. It was General William Westmoreland, who just a couple years earlier had been the Supreme Commander in Vietnam. So he had a vested interest in finding out what other cases might bubble up. And this secret Pentagon task force tracked war crimes allegations. It kept tabs so the Army would never get caught flat-footed again like it did with My Lai. And whenever it could, it tamped down allegations so they didn't become public.
Hmm. In your book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, you say that there's little room for doubt, quote, that murder, torture, rape, abuse, forced displacement, home burning, specious arrest, and imprisonment without due process, close quote, were encouraged by body count minded war managers and badly trained junior officers, and abetted by General Westmoreland and his search and destroy strategy. This is hard for Americans to face. David Swanson has a website called War is a Crime, and I'm just reading James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom about the Civil War. And within that, troops on both sides murdered, tortured, raped when they came into areas, abused people. And it strikes me that in many ways, this is what happens in all wars. You have young men who are under great stress, who hate the enemy, who've inflicted injury and death upon their comrades, and they retaliate with no concern for the other, particularly in the case when we're fighting people of color. So someone might ask, this is all known, but isn't it like kind of saying Uncle Ralph is drooling at the Thanksgiving dinner? In other words, this is known, but this is something that we put our fingers in our ears and go, la, 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 la. You know, these are our boys. These are our troops. Why make all of this public, I guess, is the question that many people would ask.
Well, I do, in the book, in Kill Anything That Moves, I do try to put everything into context, that basically the average American troops in Vietnam, infantrymen, were 18, 19, 20-year-old American boys. They were really put in untenable situations. It was an extremely harsh environment that they were in. They were tasked to fight an enemy they generally couldn't discern from the civilian population. So they were in it was very hard for them to figure out exactly what they were supposed to be doing. You can't remove all culpability from people. It's never under the laws of war acceptable to kill women and children in cold blood. But I try and show some nuance there and show exactly what American troops were faced with. And I think when people read my book, they'll find that the great deal of the onus is put on the American military, the command structure at the time. They didn't give these American troops much guidance. The laws of war training that they provided to them was exceptionally lackluster. This goes for the young officers that led the troops. And basically, the U.S. military's command policies and its basic strategy and tactics during the war, that's what made it inevitable that large numbers of civilians would be killed. In my book, I try and tell a story that's punctuated by the records that show things like massacres and murder and rape and assault took place. But what really caused Vietnamese civilian suffering were the deliberate U.S. policies, things like unrestrained bombing of the countryside and artillery shelling across wide swaths of rural Vietnam where most Vietnamese lived. This is how most Vietnamese were killed and wounded during the war. And, it isn't just a story of, small patrols mm-hmm. carrying out massacres.
My guest is Nick Turse. That's T-U-R-S-E. You can go to nickturse.com. And there'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. The book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And talking about the horrendous acts against the civilian population carried out by American troops there. And if there are men or probably mostly men that were there or anyone else would like to email me, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com for any comments that you may have about this. You mentioned about the unrestricted bombing. Noam Chomsky, the famed linguist and social critic, said that when you ask Americans how many civilians died in Vietnam, we know exactly almost how many Americans died, but when you say how many Indochinese died, there's a blank, and sometimes people say, I don't know, 200,000, 300,000, and he says it would be like asking Germans how many Jews perished in the concentration camps, and them coming up with a figure like that, although there was many more in Nazi-occupied Germany. But how many civilians actually died as a result of the war?
Well, the best estimates that we have indicate about 2 million Vietnamese civilians died during the war, most of them in South Vietnam, which was America's Vietnamese ally during the war. So this was the quote-unquote friendly population.
Yeah.
And you add to that about 5.3 million civilian wounded if you use a very conservative method of estimation. Around 11 million Vietnamese were made refugees during the war, about 4 million exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. So you have suffering on an almost unimaginable scale.
And this was all created, folks, you may remember by now, this is common coin, was denied back then, that the pretext for the United States entering the Vietnam War in great numbers was a fabricated incident. So, but let's go on, Nick Turse, with your book, Kill Anything That Moves. Tell us about the Vietnam veterans that you approached. First, I'd like to know sort of the methodology. How were you even able to get a hold of men that had served there?
Well, when I came across those records in the National Archives, that was really my starting point. These records had the names of men who had served in the war and then talked to Army criminal investigators about what they had seen. So that was a starting point for me. And from there, I went on and used other U.S. military records. And, I ended up talking to well over 100 American veterans over the course of writing this book. And, some of them I talked to on the phone and some I just showed up on their doorstep. Some of them were named as perpetrators of crimes. Some were witnesses. One that really sticks out in my mind, who affected my life greatly, was Jamie Henry. And Jamie was a self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district prior to the war. But he was drafted, and he became a medic, and by all accounts, a very good one. He saved a lot of American lives and was praised by a lot of his fellow troops. But he was also shocked by what he saw in Vietnam. On his first day in the field, he told me how he watched the point man of his patrol, the lead man, molest a young girl. And he said he thought to himself, you know, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing weeks and months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place. He saw a young boy who was kicked in the stomach and then taken away and executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner who was thrown off a cliff, a man held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. And, you know, after he first spoke up about this brutality, his life was threatened in Vietnam. He was told to keep his mouth shut. And even his friends came up to him and said, listen, Doc, you know, all medics were called Doc at the time. Said, listen, Doc, you know, we'll get in a firefight and you'll get shot in the back and it'll just be, you know, called in as being shot by the enemy. Said, you really better be quiet. So, you know, Jamie kept his mouth shut, but he continued to keep his eyes open and he made a catalog of all these things. And, on February 8th, 1968, it's just about a month before the My Lai massacre, his unit went into a village, and his commanding officer ordered that the civilians there be rounded up. The day before, the unit had gotten into a horrific firefight, and he was angry, and a subordinate officer said, okay, sir, I've rounded up these people. What do you want me to do? And his commanding officer issued the order, kill anything that moves.
That's the title from where your book comes from.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And and Jamie heard this over the radio, so he got up and you know, he made his way over to where the people were. He wanted to intervene. He was trying to stop it, but by the time he got there, he said about five men around them opened up on full automatic with their M16 rifles and killed, you know, it was 19 women and children.
Now, Ed, did you speak to any men who had actually participated in the war crimes? And if you're just joining us and don't like that phrase, war crimes, please know that a group was assembled by the Pentagon in the wake of the My Lai massacre that was called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. This is inside the Pentagon. There was knowledge of this and there was concern about it. But did you speak with men who had actually committed the type of crimes that you detail in your book?
I did. I was in touch with a man who I found in the records had, you know, just for an example, he had admitted to carrying out torture on enemy prisoners and detainees. And he subjected them to water torture, electrical torture, had beaten them with his fists. And I asked him about that, and he, you know, he was completely unrepentant. He said that if he was faced with you know, a Vietnam-type situation again, he would do the same thing, and he thought he had acted correctly. And there were other men that I talked to who just couldn't believe what their 19-year-old selves had done.
That's interesting, because what one, I mean, I'm trying to think back, pardon me, to when I was 19, and, you know, who was I then and who am I today? And were there any of the men that you spoke to that exhibited remorse?
Yes, certainly there were. There was one gentleman that always sticks out in my mind. He told me, you know, I was talking to him for a while. He was very jovial, had a very infectious laugh, and he talked about the war and about you know, the stresses that he was under at the time. And then he told me about a fellow member of his unit, he said, who one day when they were going through a hamlet, they were doing what U.S. troops generally did, which was burn them down. They were setting houses on fire, and a woman ran out. She was grabbing on his arm and yelling, you know, because her house was being burned down. And he said this GI pushed her away and then took the butt of his rifle and hit her square in the face. And as blood poured out of her face, he walked away laughing. And then, you know, a minute or two later, he confessed to me. He said, that GI that I told you about, he said, that was me.
Oh.
And he said, I don't know how I did it. And he said, but I live with it every day. And he said, I can't believe that's how I acted, but that's how it was. And I feel sorry every day for that.
Well, Nick Terse, what does this all tell us? It tells us, of course, that war is in some ways almost romanticized, but we live in a militaristic society where our troops are greatly respected. I'm going to be curious. Your book has just been released, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. What is going to be the reaction? I suspect that in many quarters, people will say, even if this is the case, this shouldn't be something that is uttered publicly.
Yeah, I think that is a response from a lot of quarters. You know, people generally don't, Americans don't want to hear these stories. They don't want to hear about, you know, what American troops have done in the field. These aren't, it's not popular, and it's, you know, it's generally not pleasant to think about. But I think that, especially because we've been involved in you know, serial wars, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now these quasi-covert military actions in Pakistan and Yemen, I think it is important for Americans to get some sense of what war really is about. You know, a lot of veterans are reticent to talk about things that they've seen. While I don't think the scale of the carnage in America's current wars compares to what it was in Vietnam, we still know that large numbers of civilians are being killed and wounded. And I think it's important for Americans to remain cognizant of this.
You know, I mentioned off the air before we began that some of the listenership here wasn't even born when the Vietnam War was raging. And looking at your photo, I suspect you weren't either. What drove you to this in the first place, and what do you take away from it, and what should we take away from it all?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, I really stumbled upon these records. I was at the time researching, you know, post-traumatic stress among U.S. Vietnam veterans. So I was learning about the war, and then I found the records and realized they weren't anywhere in the literature. And you know, I thought it was important for Americans to know. So kind of set out on a journey, and it took me into unexpected places, and you know, the story that I wanted to tell kind of evolved as I went, and especially as I talked to Vietnamese witnesses and survivors of the war on the ground in Vietnam. And it really gave me a better idea of what war is really about. I don't think I had a clear idea, even after I wrote, you know, a 1,000-page dissertation from the records, you know, a doctoral dissertation on these records. But I really don't think I knew about the war until I first went to Vietnam to try and track down witnesses and survivors from these cases. And when I did, what the Vietnamese told me about was not the one spasm of violence that I was there to look into, but what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, and how they negotiated their lives, just figuring out when to come out of a bunker and when not to, when it was safe to go out and farm and when not to. These are things that I didn't understand until I got there, and I think that it's incumbent for Americans to understand if we're going to send our brothers and sisters and sons and daughters to war, that what that war means for people abroad.
Yeah. And one thing to look at, I mentioned earlier that the original buildup, the huge buildup in Vietnam, came about as around a falsified incident. So it was true in the Mexican War and the Spanish-American War and the First World War and the Iraq War. We just got to be real careful about this, because most of these wars never had to be fought, and these kind of horrors, both perpetrated and experience never had to occur. Well, Nick Turse, I want to thank you for being a guest on my show. The book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. My guest has been Nick Turse, T-U-R-S-E. You can go to nickturse.com and or my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. There'll be a link to the book. I know this is controversial. This book has just come out, so I think we're going to start seeing some real waves about this. I'm very curious as to how this is all going to play. If you'd like to write me your opinion, you can write at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Nick Turse, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks very much for having me on, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio, or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
Did you know that millions of seniors are treated each year for fall-related injuries? If you or someone you love is elderly and living alone, get ready for a toll-free number that could save a life. LifeStation is a medical alert system that provides the security and peace of mind to live a fulfilling and independent life in the comfort of your own home. Call LifeStation now at 1-855-322-5013. For less than a dollar a day, LifeStation offers quick access to medical help at just the touch of a button, 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. And with LifeStation, there's no setup fee and no long-term contracts. You can cancel at any time. Call right now for more information at no obligation. 1-855-322-5013. Put emergency help at your fingertips while maintaining your independence. Call LifeStation at 1-855-322-5013. The call and information are free. 1-855-322-5013. That's 1-855-322-5013.
This is your Car Care Minute. Email, texting, and Twitter are some of today's communication tools. But when it comes to vehicle repair or service, a face-to-face meeting with your automotive technician is still the best method of communication to ensure a satisfactory service. But do your homework before taking your vehicle in for repairs or service. Read your owner's manual. Make a written list of your vehicle's dashboard warning signals or changes in performance and handling. Go through your list with the technician or service consultant. Let them diagnose and recommend a remedy, but do ask questions regarding the costs before work begins. Two-way communication. It's the key to better automotive service. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How'd you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out, but between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
101 RIF. That rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
This makes me so excited.
Everything that rocks. That rocks.
Doesn't anybody ever know? Doesn't anybody ever know? Doesn't anybody ever know?